Book 3, Jean de Brébeuf, Gabriel l'Allemand, Chapter 6. Jean de Brébeuf was one of the most resourceful, stout-hearted, and persevering of all the missionaries who worked to evangelize the American Indians. Physically powerful and of towering stature, he was the only one of the 8 canonized Jesuit martyrs of North America to exceed 50 years of age. All the others were born and died within the first half of the 17th century. He was among the first missionaries to enter Huronia and among the last to leave, and for years he was alone there. He wrote voluminously, revealing even his interior life at the request of his superior. So much did he accomplish, and so steadfastly did he labor, that it is scarcely too much to say that in a drama of surpassing characters, he played the leading role. Brébeuf was born on March 25th, 1593, at Condé-sur-Vire, near Lisieux, home of the Little Flower, and not far from Bayeux, famous for its tapestry. He was descended from a noble Normandy family, among whom had been 2 crusaders, and a Brébeuf who had fought with William the Conqueror in the Battle of Hastings. Virtually, nothing is known of the first 24 years of his life. In November 1617, being then 24, he entered the Society of Jesus at Rouen, and his unfailing obedience to the letter of the law and to its spirit persisted from his noviceship to the end. "I will be ground to powder," he used to say, "rather than break a rule." His sense of humility prompted him to ask to be a lay brother and no more, but his superiors prevailed upon him to work toward the priesthood. 2 years later, November 8, 1619, he pronounced his first vows and was assigned to teach at the College of Rouen. His health failed him, however, and he could neither teach nor study for the prescribed length of time. At the Jesuit residence at Pontoise, he recuperated and covered enough theology to be ordained on February 19, 1622. He celebrated his first Mass on April 4th in the College Church of Rouen, and in the following year, he became College Treasurer. When the Récollet missionary fathers in New France appealed for help in carrying the gospel to the Indians, Brébeuf volunteered. With Fathers Charles Lalemant and Enemond Massé, and 2 lay brothers, he sailed from Dieppe on April 24, 1625. Emery de Caillon, a Huguenot, was then commander at Quebec, and when the vessel came into the port at the city, Caillon was ready with an unpleasant surprise for the 5 Jesuits. Declaring they had not the proper credentials, he refused to let them land. Dumbfounded, the Jesuits looked in dismay at one another and at Quebec, 100 yards away. Then, knowing they had received authorization from the proper officials in France, they protested hotly. Meanwhile, the superior of the Récollets, Father Joseph Le Caron, had rowed out to the boat. First welcoming the Jesuits, he turned to Caillon and demanded that the Jesuits be allowed to stay in Quebec until any necessary legal documents were obtained. "There is no room for them," said Caillon, "either in the fort or in the settlement." The question was neither asked nor answered whether there would have been room if their credentials had been satisfactory. "Then I'll make room for them in the Récollet convent," said Le Caron, "and I'll assume full responsibility for their landing." Thereupon, he took the Jesuits in his boat to the small Récollet residence. Although it was crowded even for the 4 or 5 Récollets who were there, Le Caron, with good Franciscan hospitality, gave to the Jesuits the best that he had in his poverty. Le Caron unfolded to the newcomers the story of the avarice and non-cooperation of the fur-trading Montmorency Company and of their failure to develop the colony in return for the fur monopoly granted to them. After Champlain had founded Quebec in 1608, 6 years before he invited the Récollets to come to New France and evangelize the Redmen, the Huguenot merchants had acquired full control of the trade, which they retained until the British fleet under David Kirke drove out Champlain in 1629. Even now, Father Le Caron explained to the Jesuits, 17 years after Champlain founded the colony as the beginning of the French Empire in the New World, there are only 51 French winter residents in all of New France. The Huguenot bankers and merchants have done nothing toward helping to colonize or to develop the missions. In truth, they have hindered both enterprises at every turn and have caused more trouble than all the savages from Gaspé to Lake Huron. The Recollet fathers, however, had little time for futile recriminations, for there was work to do. They helped the Jesuits start a residence of their own, familiarized them with the problems of wilderness travel and Huron conversion, then set out for Three Rivers to meet their fellow Recollet, Father Nicholas Biel, whom we have mentioned. Biel was due back from his labors in Huronia, but when the last canoe of the Indian flotilla had arrived at that trading post, there was still no sign of him. The Recollets inquired anxiously among the Hurons and were met with stony silence. A rumor soon reached them that the missionary had been drowned in the rapids now known as Sault aux Recollets, north of Montreal. Soon, some of the Indians were seen wearing for ornament various articles of vestment. Next, many of the mass utensils were found hidden in one of the canoes. Bit by bit, the tragic story was pieced together. Father Biel had been robbed and murdered by the Hurons with whom he was traveling, and his body thrown into the river. The Recollets later recovered the body and brought it to Quebec for burial. Although Father Le Caron expressed his belief that the Hurons were the most likely Indians to respond to the missionary's efforts, this violent incident alarmed Father Charles Lalemant, superior of the Jesuit group, and prompted him to await a more favorable opportunity to send out missionaries to them. Brebeuf had been eager to begin his work, and this delay must have disappointed him, but he accepted the decision with cheerfulness and good grace. When it was learned shortly after that a band of Montagnais Indians near Quebec, where the Jesuits were marking time, were to soon set out on a hunting trip into the forest, Brebeuf obtained permission to accompany them. He stepped into one of their canoes on October 20th, 1625, and so started his long and turbulent career in the uncharted wilderness of New France. For work and recreation during the day, there was walking long miles through the forest. For a bed on which to sleep at night, there was a layer of leaves or pine needles on the ground. For food, until game could be caught, there were smoked eels warmed in tepid water. Each morning, the squaws added eels to the unwashed kettles, and into the slimy depths reached coppery arms. Brebeuf soon grew stiff in every limb from the plodding and the trotting, but worse, he was lonely. He could not communicate with his companions, save by gestures. The Indians seemed very different now from the Indians he had observed at the trading settlements. There they were gay and voluble, outdoing one another with shrill cackles and good-natured grunts. Here they were stolid and taciturn. There they had been all helpfulness and understanding. Here, when he pointed at objects and inquired their names, they deliberately confused him and taught him obscenities. Brebeuf was shocked by their unhygienic habits and their sexual practices. There was no concealment of the body or its functions, and he soon observed that, although braves and squaws formed a kind of family union for begetting and rearing children, promiscuity was general among young and old. If wandering bands of Indians joined his party in hunting or feasting or at the camps along the way, males and females seemed as promiscuous as the dogs. And why he refused their invitations was beyond their understanding. Deeply mired in animal impulses and webbed in superstition, fantastically committed to manitous and sorcerers, demons and medicine men, volatile, unreliable, unpredictable, to prey to lightning-like fears, they would require years of work and the grace of God, reflected Brebeuf, to rise from their degradation. They were mischievous and cunning, arrogant, vengeful, cruel, and the Jesuit realized the magnitude of the task of reshaping them by education, discipline, and prayer into the spiritual image of Christ. And not for a moment did he flinch from the enterprise into which he had plunged. As the months of the wintry hunt went by, Brebeuf, while making no apparent progress toward conversion, did commence to master the Montagnier's version of the Algonquin language. And the challenge was no small one, for the lipless, inarticulate vocables were dismaying to cope with at first. The Indians did not seem to use their mouths at all in speech. Rather, they emitted words from their throats in such a manner that the words seemed to originate in their lungs and stomachs. Only after untiring study was Brebeuf able to discriminate the meanings of utterances by their cadence and intonation. His ear was keen, his natural talent for languages was considerable, and despite the Indians' mischievous non-cooperation, he succeeded that winter in composing a grammar and a dictionary of the language. More important still, by slow degree, he had softened the hearts of the Indians and won their respect and admiration. After 5 months in the piercing cold and the primitive life of the forest, the party returned to the St. Lawrence. On March 27, 1626, 2 days after his 33rd birthday, Brebeuf was joyously welcomed at the gate of the Recollet garden. In his absence, the Jesuit residence had been nearly completed. Father Lallemant had also accompanied a band of Montagnais into the forest, but after a week they returned for lack of game. Near the end of June, 5 vessels arrived at Tadoussac, 125 miles downriver from Quebec, with reinforcements of 3 Jesuits, Father Philibert Noireau, Father Anne de Nouet, and Brother Jean Gaufestre. They arrived at Quebec on July 14th. At this time, to add to the cheerful excitement, Champlain assumed full control of Quebec as lieutenant governor. Emery de Caen was permitted to superintend the fur trading during the summer, but was forbidden to stay in Quebec. This, of course, would mean full support of the missionaries, who, under Caen, had had none. Father Lallemant believed that conditions were favorable for sending missionaries into Huronia. Preparations were made for the 1,000-mile journey which would be undertaken by the 2 Jesuits, Brebeuf and Nouet, and the Recollet Father de la Roche. They would accompany the Huron party which had been trading at Quebec. Places were found in the canoes for Roche and Nouet, but the Indians demurred at taking Brebeuf because of his great size. Finally, a brave was persuaded by generous gifts to take him. The flotilla set out from Quebec on July 25, 1625. The route would take them along the Ottawa and Nipissing rivers, down the French River to Georgian Bay, and out from the bay into Lake Huron. Jean remained crouched in the canoe for hours, scarcely daring to move for fear of irritating the fretful Indians. Save for the lapping of the water against the sides of the canoe and the grunts of the Indians, Brebeuf was in a silent world of river and forest. His back ached, and his legs grew cramped from discomfort of his motionless position, and relief did not come until the sun was setting and the redskins pulled to the shore. After a supper of watery cornmeal, the natives stretched out around the campfire, and oblivious of the swarming mosquitoes, were soon fast asleep. Brebeuf writes vividly of the trails and waters which he followed during the trip. Of 2 ordinary difficulties, the chief is that of the rapids and gorges. All the rivers of this country are full of them, and notably the St. Lawrence, after that of the prairies is passed. For from there onward, it is no longer a smooth bed, but is broken up in several places, rolling and leaping in a frightful way like an impetuous torrent, and even in some places It falls down suddenly from an enormous height. Now, when these rapids or torrents are reached, it is necessary to land and carry on the shoulder through woods or over high and troublesome rocks all the baggage and the canoes themselves. This is not done without much work, for there are portages of 1, 2, and 3 leagues, and for each several trips must be made, no matter how few packages one has. In some places, where the current is not less strong than in these rapids, although easier at first, the savages get into the water and haul and guide by hand their canoes with extreme difficulty and danger. They sometimes get in up to the neck and are compelled to let go of their hold, saving themselves as best they can from the rapidity of the water, which snatches their canoe from them and bears it off. I kept count of the number of portages and found that we carried our canoes 35 times and dragged them at least 50. The second ordinary difficulty which Poyboeuf mentions is that of the food, which normally consists of no more than Indian corn mashed between 2 stones. Add to these difficulties, he points out, that one must sleep on the bare earth or on the hard rock, for lack of space 10 or 12 feet square on which to place a wretched hut, that one must endure continually the stench of tired-out savages, and must walk in water, in mud, in the obscurity and entanglement of the forest, where the stings of an infinite number of mosquitoes and gnats are a serious annoyance. We all had to begin by these experiences to bear the cross that our Lord presents to us for his honor and for the salvation of these poor barbarians. In truth, I was sometimes so weary that the body could do no more, but at the same time my soul experienced very deep peace, considering that I was suffering for God. The Hurons, who had been so reluctant to take on the heroically built Brebeuf, found him an admirable traveler. He had paddled his share, he was not sick, he had been invariably pleasant, and apparently had not rocked the boat. Seeing him pick up a heavy pack and carry it with a back unbent over a long portage, the Hurons named him Echon, meaning the man who carries the load. At last the long journey against buffeting currents and over long portages was ended, and the canoes were beached on the shores of Penetanguishene Bay, off the larger Georgian Bay. The missionaries had travelled in widely separated groups of the flotilla, and now Brebeuf was escorted by the Indians a short distance inland to the Huron village of Toanche. When he looked about him at the copper-skinned natives who thronged to see him, he felt with uprising joy that he had at last found his clients. They would be his children and he their father, and he would stay with them to the end. Brebeuf learned that Father de la Roche had arrived at another village and shortly afterwards was rejoined by Father de Nouet, who had not made an altogether good impression during the trip. Fresh from France and not having had the benefit of an apprenticeship such as Brebeuf had undergone the winter before, he had suffered from hunger and retchings and the terrifying loneliness in the wilderness. His unadaptability had occasioned angry whacks from the Indians, and from these he suffered also. To be in the protective company of Father Jean de Brebeuf was a relief. Toanche was a cluster of about 15 longhouses, rectangular and permanent. They ranged in length from about 20 to 80 feet, and in each, depending upon its length, dwelt from 6 to 20 families. They were afflicted with the shortcomings and annoyances universally found among Indian habitations. The smoke inflamed the eyes, there was no privacy, the stench of decaying food and urine, of grease and human bodies, floated through the thick atmosphere. Lice and fleas infested the bunks and clothing, mice and rats scurried across the floor. It was all very trying, particularly so to Nouet, a man of more than usually delicate sensibilities, who had had no experience in the primitive life. Brebeuf observed that the Hurons were taller than the Montagnais Indians and the French, and they were lithe and muscular. Their hair was abundant, straight as wires, and jet black, while they were hairless on chin and body. In the cabins, and during warm weather, The men went naked except for a breechcloth or a dangling pad of leather. The elder women, Brébeuf recorded, wore a skin or cloth hanging loosely from shoulder to knee. The young women wore only a skirt about their hips. Children of both sexes went perfectly naked. With all their crudities, Brébeuf found the Hurons friendly and hospitable. They would never close their door to a stranger, he writes, and having once received him in their houses, they share with him the best of what they have and never send him away. When he leaves of his own accord, he acquits his debt with a simple thank you. Under this system, the two black robes were at liberty to live in any cabin they chose, eat from any pot, and remain with any family as long as they wished. Soon after they had settled, Brébeuf and Nouet visited the Récollet Father de la Roche at the village where he was staying, Kionanaskaran. This was the capital village of the Bear Nation, and it was fortified by a triple row of palisades, the posts being 20 feet high and closely planted. Within the crowded enclosure were about 50 longhouses containing some 500 families. It was one of the largest Huron villages, and its leaders were among the most powerful of all the Huron peoples. The Jesuits found Roche dwelling in a lodge built 10 years before for Father Le Caron and used since then by the Récollets and the French fur traders. The lodge was divided into three rooms, and Roche invited the Jesuits to stay on with him there. Brébeuf, desirous of learning the language and habits of the Hurons, declined the tempting offer. The three missionaries went to pay their respects to the chiefs and elders of the Bear Nation assembled at Kionanaskaran. They were welcomed cordially by the chiefs, who pledged them peace and friendship, while the braves applauded with vigorous belly laughs. Back at Toanche, Brébeuf applied himself to the multiple tasks of mastering the Huron tongue, examining their customs and learning their beliefs. Before he could admit them to baptism, he would have to root out their superstitions and wean them from their inveterate vices. He realized the dimensions of the problem, for the practices of the Hurons were similar to those he had noted among the Montagnais. Even as the Montagnais had done, the Hurons satisfied their sexual instincts with little decency or control and expected the missionaries to do likewise. The Jesuits were continually embarrassed by being pursued by the Indian women, who begged them to marry them or make some sort of family alliance. The women and girls importuned them more insistently even than did the men, who actively petitioned them on behalf of the females. What made it more difficult for the missionaries to resist plausibly the advances of the women and explain to the men that such conduct was contrary to the Christian code was the example of some of the French agents who lived among the Hurons and became fully as degraded as the Indians in their practices. Fortified by grace, however, the missionaries were immune. Brébeuf's chastity, wrote his confessor, was proof, and in that matter his eyes were so faithful to his heart that they had no sight for the objects which might have soiled his purity. His body was not rebellious to the spirit, and in the midst of impurity itself, which reigns, it seems, in this country, he lived in an innocence as great as if he had sojourned in the midst of a desert inaccessible to that sin. A woman presented herself to him one day, in a place somewhat isolated, uttering to him unseemly language and breathing a fire that could come only from a firebrand of hell. The father, seeing himself thus attacked, made upon himself the sign of the cross without answering any word, and this specter, disguised beneath a woman's dress, disappeared at the same moment. On October 26th, Father de la Roche set out with two French agents to visit the Pétains toward the west, proposing to winter among the neutrals in the south. In doing so, the Récollet was following the advice of Father Le Caron in opening new mission fields and of Champlain in suggesting alliances and attracting these nations to the French trade. Late in the winter, rumors reached Toanche that Roche was being badly treated by the neutrals. Brébeuf persuaded the French agent to to make the six-day journey and bring the missionary back if he still survived. Walsh and the agent returned toward the end of March. For 3 months, he reported, he had been hospitably entertained by the neutrals. But then, Huron mischief makers came on the scene. They told the neutrals that I was a powerful magician, that I tainted the air in the Huron country, that I had already poisoned many Huron people, that I was going to be killed soon to prevent me from setting fire to the village and burning all the children to death. In spite of the difficulties brought down upon him, Roche was convinced that the neutrals could be converted more easily than the Hurons and could be persuaded to form alliances with the French for peace and trade. The Oekole found no Huron converts upon his return, but he observed a marked reformation effected by the black robes upon the French agents. "What consoled me," he wrote, "on my return from the neutrals was to see that our fellow countrymen had made their peace with our Lord, for they confessed and received communion at Easter. They have put away their women, and since then have been more restrained." The old Recollet cabin at Kiananaskaran, through age, continual use, and general decrepitude, had become uninhabitable, and the three missionaries had a new cabin built for themselves and the French agents near Toanche. Instead of the totems that adorned the cabins of the Hurons, they hung a large wooden cross above the door and painted it red. Here the priests could pray without being suspected of witchery. Here they would be spared the vermin, the stenches, the promiscuous sexuality, the orgies of the sorcerers, with which by now they were all too familiar. In this cabin, perhaps, a chapel might one day be fitted out where Mass could be celebrated. Meanwhile, Father Anne de Nouet was not making much progress with the difficult Huron language, and in spite of his brave intentions, the primitive ways of the Indians were too much for his fine sensibilities. Accordingly, Brebeuf thought it advisable for him to return to Quebec, where he could be of genuine service. In June, this saintly man, who had borne the crudities of the red men and their hardships of life without complaint, joined a large flotilla of Hurons and French agents leaving for the trade at Cap de la Victoire. When the French agents returned in September, they brought dismal news from Quebec. Father Noiraud had left Honfleur, France, with provisions for the Jesuits and their workmen, but the vessel was thought to have lost its way. Expecting a shortage of food during the coming winter, Father Charles Lalemant was obliged to send the Jesuit workmen back to France. For another reason, he himself followed them to the mother country. He had been deputed by Champlain and the Récollets to represent them in France in the continuing struggle against Caen and the Montmorency Company, who were showing no inclination to support the interests of New France. Saddest of all to Brebeuf in the immediate picture was the fact that no Jesuit had come with the flotilla to help him in the lonely struggle to evangelize Huronia. Now, many of the Huron braves, streaked with black and crimson paint, flourishing tomahawks, and uttering blood-curdling battle cries, were whirling off on the warpath against their traditional enemies, the Iroquois. Not long after, some commenced to return, wailing over the death of their comrades. Others led back their captives and proudly displayed the scalps that dangled from their belts. Of this, Brebeuf noted, "When they capture some of their enemies, they treat them with all the cruelty they can. For 6 days will sometimes pass in assuaging their fury and in burning them at slow fires. Not satisfied with roasting their skin, they slash the legs, the thighs, the arms, and the fleshiest parts, and thrust glowing brands or red-hot hatchets into them. After having finally killed the victims, they tear out their hearts, if they were brave men, roast them on the embers, and distribute pieces of them to the young people. They consider that this will make them brave. Others make incisions in the upper part of the throats of their own young men, and cause some of the dead man's blood to run into it, They say that since the blood of the enemy has been mingled with theirs, they will never be surprised by him and will be enabled to know of his approach, however secret it may be. The victims are put into cauldrons piece by piece, although at other feasts the head, whether of a dog, bear, deer, or big fish, is the portion of the chief. In this case, the head is given to the lowest person. Some taste this dish and the rest of the body only with much horror, but there are some who eat it with pleasure. I have observed savages speaking with gusto of the flesh of an Iroquois and praising its goodness in the same terms they use for the flesh of a deer or a moose. This is being cruel, but we hope, with the help of heaven, that the knowledge of the true God will entirely banish such barbarity from this country. As Brebeuf studied their beliefs, he gradually came to perceive the enormous importance they attached to their dreams. These ruled and tyrannized their whole life. If even a chief of the tribe argues one way, a dream will prevail if it argues differently. A dream, writes Brebeuf, prescribes the feasts, the dances, the songs, the games, in a word, the dream does everything here, and in truth is to be regarded as the chief god of the Hurons. High confidence was likewise placed in their charms, for which their word was oki, meaning also demon. A fishbone, a queerly shaped pebble, a beaver's tooth, or the ashes of a bird would be consulted as to what course they should pursue. In such objects resided demons who had power to help or to hinder and who must under all circumstances be obeyed. Brebeuf noticed also the power of the sorcerers who swayed the lives of the natives at every turn. They claimed power to control the weather, to find lost objects, and to predict future events. To cure the sick, they prescribed remedies which had not the slightest relation to the illness. They believed that all diseases were caused by little demons which crept into the body of the victim, and these they would try to frighten away. For guidance in the appropriate ritual to accomplish this, they turned to dreams, okis, and incantations. In certain cases, the sorcerers would prescribe elaborate ceremonials, such as the fire dance, the nude dance, the festival of the madmen, or such ritual feasts as the eat-all or the vomit feasts. The sorcerers were obeyed down to the smallest detail, and so were a constant menace to the health and sanity of the natives. The missionaries would try to explain to the people the lack of causal relation between sicknesses and the prescribed cures, and so were viewed with suspicion, jealousy, and hatred by the sorcerers. Some of the missionaries thought that the Hurons recognized no god, but worshipped only a demon, or oki. Others thought, more specifically, that they had a good demon and a bad demon. Brebeuf, who lived closest to them and over the longest period of any of the Jesuits, was of the opinion that the Hurons had a faint, hazy notion of God, but that this notion was not strong nor clear enough to prompt them to serve or to honor him. They did believe in survival of the soul after death, but the soul was regarded as a material object. The Hurons appeared not to have a concept of reward or punishment after death, but during the span of earthly life, they did fear the wrath of the great Oki, the power which regulated the seasons, the elements, and other forces. To propitiate this power and obtain its aid, they would throw tobacco into the flames, sacrifice living animals, and offer the flesh of victims of violent death. These practices would seem to confirm Brebeuf's view that the Hurons had some perverted notion of God and were a degenerate people clinging to a remnant of a revelation which their ancestors had possessed. This people, he writes, is not so stupefied that it does not seek and acknowledge something more lofty than the senses. since their licentious life and their lewdness prevent them from finding God, it is very easy for the devil to insinuate himself and to offer them his services in the urgent need in which he sees them. May he, who has saved us by the blood of the Immaculate Lamb, consent to remedy these superstitions as soon as possible, accepting for this purpose, if need be, our souls and our lives, which we most freely offer to him for the salvation of these peoples and the remission of our sins. Gradually mastering the Huron language, Brebeuf was puzzled in his request for some means to express spiritual and abstract concepts so that the Hurons could grasp them. Their vocabulary, as he also had discovered in the case of the Montagnais, was limited to concrete sensuous objects. They had no word for a supreme being, God. They could comprehend the idea only through some circumlocution as he who made all or he who knows all. Through similar manipulation of words, he succeeded in translating into Huron the Catechism of Ledesma, a basic pamphlet of 4 short chapters. This was to serve as a handbook for future missionaries and to spare them the grubbing labor he had expended. In the spring, Father de la Roche decided to go to Quebec. He and Brebeuf, living alone in their cabin, badly needed artifacts from the French with which to barter for their food. Also, their garments were tattered and needed replacing. Furthermore, the Récollet was feeling the strain of primitive living and would benefit from some rest and a change. Even more important, he wished to report to his superior, Father Le Caron, and to Champlain, and the French fur trade directors, the advantages, which they had long suspected, of cultivating the neutrals as well as the Hurons, and independently of these. Near the end of June, Roche joined a large convoy of Huron canoes about to start their journey down the Ottawa River to the Cap de la Victoire. With them went the French agents and their annual load of peltries. Roche bade an affectionate farewell to his Jesuit confrère, stepped into a waiting canoe, and was on his way. Brebeuf was alone in the Red Man's Wilderness. Brebeuf had been 2 years at Tawantche. For all his unwearying zeal and unending efforts, he had not baptized a single adult Huron. He had received no reinforcements to carry on the unequal struggle. Indeed, his 2 fellow laborers had gone back to Quebec. What could one priest do in this very heart of paganism? Little by himself, he thought, much with God. Brebeuf had accomplished wonders with the opaque Huron language, and with this advantage he would press on even more vigorously in his 3rd year to explain to the natives the saving truths of Christianity. In the summer of 1628, a terrible drought fell upon all Huronia. Months passed, and not a drop of rain fell on the parched fields. The country was dry as tinder, and fires sprang up everywhere. The corn was drying out. Famine, the following winter, loomed. The squaws were growing hysterical at the prospect. The thumping of the tortoise drum echoed drearily day and night as the sorcerers persevered in their dances and in their incantations to stir the thunderbird into action. But it was in vain. Finally, one of the leading sorcerers, Terenhegnon, announced to the villagers that his demon had revealed the cause of his own failure to bring rain. The thunderbird would not bring the clouds because it feared the red cross on the black robe's house. One of his chiefs summoned Brebeuf and said to him, "You do not wish to be the cause of our deaths. We believe that you should take down that red cross and hide it in your cabin or in the lake, so that the clouds might not see it. Then, when the rain comes and the harvest is gathered, you may put it up again."
"My uncle," replied Ichon, "I shall never take down or hide the cross on which he who brings blessings died. I cannot prevent you from removing it, but be on your guard against the master of all when he is angry. What Tiron Hagnon tells you is nonsense, as you can see for yourselves, for since that cross has been there, you have often had an abundance of rain." "It is not so much the cross," rejoined the chief. "It is mostly the color." Brebeuf was aware of the Huron belief that thunder is the result of a celestial turkey flapping its wings, and that no turkey takes kindly to red. He thought, therefore, he might well humor them, so he painted the cross white. The drought continued in its burning fury, and the wrath of the crazed Hurons fell upon the sorcerer. Then Brebeuf made a proposal. "Come here tomorrow," he said, "and let us honor the cross after the Christian fashion, and we shall see if we can get rain." Ichon painted the cross red again and hung it on a small crucifix. When the Hurons came the next morning, he recited some prayers. Then he and the Hurons, in turn, kissed the crucifix. "On that same day," relates Brebeuf, "God gave them rain, and in the end a plentiful harvest as well as a profound admiration for the divine power. In consequence, Brebeuf became in their eyes a great sorcerer." This was a title of distinction, but it was fraught with danger. Anyone could kill a sorcerer when he failed to produce results. But the halo was his for the rest of his life among the Hurons, and it was not a comfortable one. He walked always under the threat of death. The Huron traders returned that fall in a state of unholy wrath. The French had not come to meet them at Cap de la Victoire, and the Redskins were obliged to return with their load of furs instead of the French goods that they so badly needed. From the agents, Brebeuf learned that Quebec had been hungering all through the previous winter and spring, for Caen had not sent food or articles enough for the Huron trade, and more, the French fleet had not come that summer, and it was rumored that English ships were anchored at Tadoussac to intercept them if they appeared. This was shocking news. It meant that Brebeuf would be without food, clothing, beads, and French artifacts he needed for the coming years. Even more disheartening was the news that no French priest would be with him. Alone among the fickle Indians, without the consolation of confession or the support and companionship of priestly confreres, and thus deprived of all human aid in his superhuman enterprise, Jean de Brebeuf threw himself upon the aid and mercy of God. More than ever, he must find in God the strength, the will, and the courage to live the interior life so perfectly that he can transcend the crudeness of the pagan environment. He attests that God did not fail him. "As for the dangers of the soul, so to speak frankly, there is none for him who brings the fear and love of God to the Huron country. On the contrary, I find unparalleled advantages for acquiring perfection." It was an echo of St. Paul. "Who is there who can hurt you, if you be zealous of good?" Over the lonely winter months, Brebeuf spoke more frequently to the Hurons about God, Jesus Christ, and his gospel of love and mercy. He spoke to them also by his unselfish, holy, Christ-like life. He visited the sick in their cabins and strove to be their servant in all things. He was still not prepared to make converts, except in the case of Hurons in danger of death. Only in this circumstance, since he wanted no backsliders or apostates, did he deem it prudent to baptize them after they had been instructed in the fundamentals of the Christian faith. A French agent came to Brebeuf's cabin late the following May. He had been sent by Champlain, and he carried a letter from Father Enemond Massé. The agent reported to Brebeuf that the French were starving at Quebec. The summer before, the English had threatened Quebec and had captured the French fleet. There was every danger that the English or the French Huguenots would again blockade the St. Lawrence and possibly attack Quebec. Brebeuf and the French traders among the Hurons were to come to Quebec, bringing as much corn as they could obtain from the natives. Massé's letter reiterated Champlain's order to hasten back. Brebeuf was stunned. His dreams of launching a great crusade among the Hurons were shattered. He had conquered their language and their hearts. He knew their minds, their beliefs, their very impulses. He was in a position to influence them strongly toward the Christian faith. Now this would all have to wait. In God's good time he would return. He had laid a firm groundwork, and one day he would erect here the edifice of Christianity. The Hurons were genuinely heartbroken. He had won his way into their hearts and was high in their esteem. "We have asked you," said one old man, "to teach us more. What shall we do when you go away?" One of Brebeuf's last acts before departing was to baptize a baby boy at the request of a brave who had absorbed the missionary's teaching and wanted his boy to be raised a Christian. In mid-July, the 12 canoes of Brebeuf's party and the 8 canoes of the French agents and their Huron companions, loaded with as much corn as was possible to bring, struck out from the cove below Tonche. It was spring, and the Ottawa River would be swollen with the thaws. The cascades would be frothing cataracts, and the stiff current would repeatedly threaten to pull their canoes into the rapids. Danger would certainly dog them all the way. Manfully, the French and the Hurons paddled and portaged the hundreds of miles of tortuous waterways and forest trails, and on the evening of July 17th, after a month of feverish struggle, the party came abreast of Quebec's bristling rock and pushed their canoes to the shore. The French inhabitants greeted them with joyous shouts and quickly unloaded the bark casks of precious corn. Champlain hurried from the fort to welcome them, eyeing with some concern the supply of corn, which was, in relation to the mouths it would have to feed and the time it would have to last, somewhat meager. From Notre-Dame-des-Anges hurried Father Massé, Anne Nouet, and the 3 Jesuit brothers. Staring at Jean de Brebeuf as if they could scarcely believe their eyes, they kept murmuring, "Thank God, thank God, you have come in time." Chapter 7. Things had been going from bad to worse for the French at Quebec. The English, determined to extend their sway over the whole of the New World, had their navy patrolling the sea lanes to the colony. Not a single French vessel was able to slip through the blockade, and the colonists' food supply was dwindling almost to the vanishing point. On July 10th, 1628, the English fleet under David Kirke appeared before Quebec and demanded immediate surrender. Although the fort had only 50 pounds of gunpowder and a daily food ration of less than 2 ounces a person, Champlain put on a strong show of force and bluffed the English into withdrawing. The winter brought increasing misery. Scurvy had broken out and fresh mounds were dotting the little cemetery. By spring, most of the colonists had abandoned the settlement and were scouring the woods and streams for game and fish. Some were living on acorns and roots. That June, Father Philibert Noireau, whose expedition the previous year had been unsuccessful, organized another voyage to bring desperately needed food and supplies to the New World. This time his ship was wrecked off Cape Canso, Nova Scotia, and he and Brother Malot lost their lives. David Kirke sailed his fleet before Quebec again on July 19th. Champlain, knowing that further resistance would be futile, capitulated. On the next day, the cross of St. George replaced the fleur-de-lis above the fort. By the terms of surrender, Recollets and Jesuits were to be expelled and were forbidden to take anything with them except their clothes and books. It was a bitter experience for the missionaries, most of all perhaps for Father Ennemond Massé, who was undergoing the frustration of exile for the second time. He had been driven out of Acadia by the English in 1613. Heavy in heart, Jean de Brebeuf lovingly bound in leather his Montagnier dictionary, his Huron phrase book, dictionary and grammar, and his Huron translation of Ledesma's catechism. Blood and tears of anguish had gone into the making of these, and it is little wonder that even the resilient spirits of the strapping Brebeuf should be depressed. Tears came into his eyes as he stood on the deck of a French vessel with Massé, Roche, Nouet, and the others, and watched the Rock of Quebec disappear behind Point Lévis, and the island of Orléans slip past. They were leaving behind them the country of the red men, to whose salvation they had dedicated their lives, their labors, and their prayers. Their dream was fading, and they could only commend their future into the hands of God. Their vessel put in at Tadoussac on the St. Lawrence. They encountered the Huguenot Emery de Caen there, and they were startled to learn from him that France and England had concluded peace in April, 3 months before. What would this mean for Quebec and the missions? It meant, first of all, that David Kirk's seizure of Quebec was not legal, that it was, in effect, an act of piracy. But as always, 9/10 of the law of nations was possession, and there were no means at hand to force Kirk and the new occupants of Quebec to relinquish what they had improperly taken and to depart quietly. Kirk held out, solid and entrenched, upon the rock. The French weighed anchor and continued on to their mother country. The moment he arrived, Champlain commenced to prod the government into action. He had to overcome mountains of lethargy on the part of a French officialdom if his country were not to lose by default what Madame de Pompadour was to later call a few acres of snow. 3 long years of unflagging effort were rewarded. Canada was restored to France on March 25, 1632, by the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. Champlain, the founder of New France, now became its savior. His lieutenant Bouchard was dispatched at once to take possession of Quebec, and with Bouchard went the Jesuits, Father Anne de Nouet, Brother Buret, and Father Lejeune, who was to be superior of the re-established missions. Meanwhile, during this exile from the New World, Jean de Brebeuf continued to be active. Reassigned to the Jesuit College at Rouen, he made his final year of probation there. Known also as the Tertianship, this period was given over to the crowning preparation of the Jesuit for his life's work. It was a year of prayer, meditation, study, and spiritual exercises. Brebeuf pronounced his final vows as a Jesuit on January 30, 1630. He was then appointed treasurer of the small Jesuit college in Eylau. Not only did he perform this new duty with fidelity, but in the spirit of his youthful assertion that he would be ground to powder before breaking a rule, he did so with unabated zeal, almost as if his heart were not still with the Hurons. Daily he prayed that he might be sent back to them. In his journal he wrote, "I have felt an ardent desire to suffer something for Jesus Christ. I fear I shall be refused, because our Lord has thus far treated me with kindness, whereas I have grievously offended him and his divine majesty. I shall be more confident of salvation when God will give me a chance to suffer." And when he made this vow, "Lord Jesus, my Redeemer, you have redeemed me by your blood and by your most precious death. That is why I promised serve you all my life in the society of Jesus and never to serve any other. I sign this promise in my blood, ready to sacrifice it all for you as willingly as this drop." He was offering his life to God. Brebeuf's prayers were answered. When Champlain, now accredited as captain of the King's Navy and lieutenant of his lordship the Cardinal Richelieu throughout the whole length of the St. Lawrence, sailed from Dieppe on March 23, 1633, at his side stood Jean de Brebeuf. The little fleet entered the St. Lawrence early in May, but floating ice prevented them from reaching Quebec until several weeks later. The cannon on the fort thundered a hearty welcome and signaled the return of the exiled Brebeuf after nearly 5 years. He was so jubilant that when he touched shore, he kissed the ground and knelt in prayer. "God knows," wrote Lejeune, "that we received and embraced him with glad hearts." The English, during their occupation, had undone much of what the French had accomplished. The Jesuits' residence had been heavily damaged and would have to be repaired, but this was nothing to compare with the demoralizing influence the English had had upon the Indians. They had sold them fire water, which caused the men and women to get drunk and fight and kill one another, and they had, to some extent, managed by this and other means to disaffect the natives towards the French. There was much to do. On July 28, a swarm of Hurons, numbering 600 or 700, came paddling to Quebec for their annual trading session. There were many who remembered Brebeuf, their beloved Etchan, and they greeted him with genuine affection. In the case of Champlain, they were a little uncertain. A group of Hurons had killed the French agent, Étienne Brûlé, and they were apprehensive that the governor might work revenge. Champlain, however, was in no mood to alienate the Hurons, whose trade and friendship were an important factor to be considered. The cautious respect which the Hurons exhibited towards Champlain was reciprocated by a full display of goodwill on his part. He explained to them that he did not plan to avenge the death of Brûlé, who had in various ways proved himself a traitor to the French and was well gotten rid of. Champlain made it clear that he was eager to resume trading with the Hurons and desired further that they should agree upon mutual friendship and protection. The relieved Indians wasted no time in exchanging furs and tobacco for hatchets, knives, kettles, cloth, beads, iron arrowheads, coats, shirts, and other articles, and during their stay they were feasted by the French. They expressed their renewed devotion to the French in many ways, and solid harmony reigned. Champlain next introduced to the assembled natives the three newly arrived missionaries, Jean de Brebeuf, Antoine Daniel, and Ambroise Davost. "These are our fathers," he said. "We love them more than we love ourselves. The whole French nation honors them. They do not go among you for furs. They have left their friends and their country to show you the way to heaven. If you love the French, as you say you love them, then love and honor these, our fathers." Deeply impressed, the Indians readily agreed to take the black robes back with them to Huronia. Thereupon, the governor led the chiefs into the chapel, and the priests explained the statues and the pictures to them. The Hurons were shown three images of the Virgin and were told who she was, puzzled. "How could Christ have three mothers?" they asked. On the eve of departure, Brebeuf, Daniel, and Davost took their baggage to the storehouse, and there they passed the night. The Hurons were encamped about them, and at 11 that night, the priests were awakened by a loud voice in the Indian camp. Looking out, they saw an Indian chief walking among the natives, haranguing them in angry tones. This was Le Borgne, One Eye, who was the chief of the Algonquin tribe La Nation de l'Île, which occupied the island of Allumettes in the Ottawa River. Members of this tribe had accompanied the Hurons on the present trading expedition. Brebeuf listened carefully to what Le Borgne was saying. "We have begged the French captain," the priest heard, "to spare the life of the Algonquin of La Petite Nation, whom he keeps in prison. But he will not listen to us. The prisoner will die. Then his people will revenge him. They will kill the three black robes whom you are about to carry to your country. If you do not defend them, the French will be angry and charge you with their death. But if you do defend them, then the Algonquins will make war upon you, and the river will be closed. If the French captain will not let the prisoner go, then leave the three black robes where they are, for if you take them with you, they will bring you to trouble." Greatly disturbed, the priests hurried to the fort, aroused Champlain, and told him what they had heard. He sent his interpreter to tell the Hurons that he wished to speak with them before their departure. The chiefs assembled, and the governor addressed them. He tried persuasion, then promises, and finally threats, but in vain. Le Borgne had successfully played upon the fears of the Hurons, convincing them that if the Algonquin prisoner of the French were not released, the black robes would surely be murdered and war would follow. Le Borgne had two objectives. One was to drive a wedge between the Hurons and the French so that his own tribe might benefit more fully from relations with the colonists. The other was to gain credit and influence with the Algonquin nation to which the prisoner belonged by securing his release. Meanwhile, he would not prejudice his own friendship with the Hurons. Champlain refused to release the prisoner, who had been apprehended for murdering a Frenchman in cold blood. He felt that it would place the French in a position of weakness to condone the murder in the first place and to yield to the threats from the Algonquin chief in the second. The upshot was that the Hurons declined to take the Jesuits with them, even though the priests offered to assume all the risks and not to involve their native friends. It was a keen disappointment to them, for they had been impatient to resume their missionary endeavors among the Hurons. The Indians paddled away, and the priests had no choice but to make other plans. Among the tribes that made their home in the neighborhood of Quebec, paganism and degraded practices were universal. Brebeuf decided to work toward evangelizing these people while his associates, in addition to helping him, would study the Huron language and so prepare for future labors in Huronia. The Jesuits followed this schedule for a year and made several remarkable conversions among the natives. Brebeuf fortified his old conviction that, properly instructed and seduced from their superstitious beliefs and immoral practices, the American Indians would make earnest and devout Christians. During this time, grievous calamities had befallen the Hurons. A pestilence had broken out among them, and its ravages had taken many lives. Then, the following summer, 500 of them, laden with furs, were paddling down the St. Lawrence to trade with the French when they were ambushed by the Iroquois. In the fight that followed, 200 Hurons were slain and another 100 taken captive. The battered remnants, instead of continuing on to Quebec as planned, stopped off at Three Rivers to seek the protection of the French. When they had patched their wounds and had done what trading was left them to do, the French renewed their earnest request of the year before that they take with them the three missionaries, Brebeuf, Daniel, and Devost, on their return trip to Huronia, along with a few French workmen who would assist the priests. The Indians were plainly reluctant to do so, but when they were loaded with presents, their adamant refusal finally gave way to fretful compliance. In surly mood, they took the Frenchmen into their canoes and set out. The long journey, beset with rapids and cascades, long overland hauls, and unabating danger from the Iroquois, was made all the more trying for the missionaries by the bad tempers of the Hurons, many of whom were sick with fever. Davost's Indian robbed him of part of his luggage, threw most of his books and writing paper into the river, then abandoned him with the Algonquins on the island of the Alamits. Daniel also was abandoned, but he managed to find another party of Hurons who took him into their canoe. Brebeuf, describing some of the severe hardships of the journey, wrote that whoever comes here must be prepared for all this, and something more, even death itself, whose image is every moment before our eyes. Not knowing how to swim, I had a very narrow escape. As we were leaving the Bissarinians while shooting a rapid, we would have gone over a high falls had not my savages promptly and skillfully leapt into the water to turn aside the canoe which the current was sweeping. On August 5th, 1634, 30 days after leaving Three Rivers, Brebeuf neared the port of Penetanguishene Bay. The ill-tempered natives unceremoniously landed him there, some distance from the spot where he had first disembarked in Huronia 8 years before. They threw his baggage on the shore after him and prepared to make off. Seeing no sign of human habitation in any direction, Brebeuf asked, "Are you going to leave me here? Will you not lead me to the nearest village? Will you not at least stay to watch these goods while I go and hunt for someone?" They made no answer. "Do you forget all I did for you?" he asked. "How I nursed you on the way up when you were sick, and cared for you when you were injured. Will you not at least keep your promise?" They glared at him in sullen silence and paddled away, and there he was, left alone in the wilderness. For their surly ill-treatment, the ever-charitable Brebeuf was prepared to excuse them. "For we know very well," he says, "how sickness alters the disposition and the inclinations of even the most sociable." When the Hurons had left him, he knelt in prayer to thank God, who in his providence had seen him safely through all his perils. "I prostrated myself upon my knees," he wrote to Lejeune, "to thank God, Our Lady, and Saint Joseph for the favors and mercies I had received during the journey. I saluted the guardian angel of the country. I offered myself with all my feeble labors to Our Lord for the salvation of these poor peoples. Since Our Lord has preserved me and guided me with so much goodness, I took hope that He would not abandon me here." Rising, Brebeuf hid his baggage in the woods, including the utensils for mass, more precious than all the rest. It was not long before he got his bearings and found the trail to Toanche. It was in ashes. Some charred poles remained of the chapel where he had made his effort to establish a beachhead for Christianity among the Hurons. I looked with tenderness and emotion on the place where we had lived and where we had celebrated the holy sacrifice of the Mass through 3 years. He walked among the ruins, and nostalgic memories came to him. Evening was near. He found a path, and bewildered and anxious, he groped his way through the gloomy forest. He came to a clearing, and there he saw the Indian village of Yenateria. They saw him robed in black, only his face and hands showing, as he emerged from the forest, tall, powerful, impressive. "Achan has come back," they cried, running to meet him. "Achan has come again," they shouted joyously as they swarmed about him. It was a heartwarming welcome for the missionary, and his feelings welled up in gratitude to God and to these spiritual children of his. He rested briefly, then set out with some young braves to find his baggage. They returned with it an hour after midnight, and Brebeuf accepted the hospitality of Awandawai, a friendly, generous brave whose cabin was unusually large and well stocked with beans and corn. In the days that ensued, Brebeuf re-established his place in the hearts of the Hurons, while he anxiously awaited the arrival of his Jesuit companions of the workmen. One by one they came, first Father Daniel, in a state of exhaustion, then Davost,
who had managed to make his way from the island of the Alamets and was half dead from starvation and fatigue. The workmen came, each with his tale of hardship and privation, and so at last they were all there, assembled under the hospitable and ample roof of Awandawe. Once more the mission to the Hurons was begun. Brebeuf selected a suitable site and drew plans for a cabin 36 feet long and 20 wide, divided into three sections. The Indians helped the French workers, and before October it was completed. It was after the Huron pattern, with its opening in the roof to allow the smoke to escape, but the division into rooms and the doors, which swung on hinges, fascinated the people. They swarmed into the house at all hours and gaped at the wonders that Brebeuf had laid out for them to see. They were alarmed by the magnifying glass, which made the bugs in their hair seem like lobsters, and the mirror with many angles, which multiplied their noses, eyes, and ears. The magnet was pure magic and must have some sort of glue on it. It was the clock which astounded them. They listened spellbound as it ticked and were stupefied when it chimed the hours. They thought it was alive and inquired what it ate. As the last stroke of the hour sounded, some of the Frenchmen would cry, "Stop!" And it obeyed. "What does Father Clock say?" they asked when the clock struck. "When he strikes 12 times," replied one of the Frenchmen, "he says, 'Hang on the kettle.' When he strikes 4 times, he says, 'Get up and go home.'" "All this," observes Brebeuf, "serves to gain their affection and to make them more docile in respect to the admirable and incomprehensible mysteries of our faith. For the opinion they have of our genius and capacity makes them believe whatever we tell them." The orders of Captain Clock were well remembered. Visitors were always on hand to share the father's sajamete, or bread, and on the stroke of 4, all rose and departed, leaving the missionaries in peace for a time. The priests would bar the door, gather about the fire, and discuss the affairs of the mission. New words and expressions of the Hurons, which each had noted, were brought to the attention of all. New problems were discussed, new solutions arrived at. Then, repairing to their primitive chapel, conscious always that the efficacy of their labors depended upon close union with God through prayer, sacrifice, and love, they would perform their religious exercises with care and devotion. Their orderly spiritual regimen is recounted by a Jesuit who later joined this mission in Inotoria, Father François de Perron. "The importunity of the savages who are continually about us in our cabin and who sometimes break down a door, throw stones at our cabin, and wound our people, this importunity, I say, does not prevent our observance of our hours as well regulated as in one of our colleges in France. At 4 o'clock, the rising bell rings, then following the orison, at the end of which the masses begin and continue until 8 o'clock. During this period, each one keeps silent, reads his spiritual book, and says his lesser hours. At 8 o'clock, the door is left open to the savages until 4 in the evening. It is permitted to talk with the savages at this time, as much to instruct them as to learn their language. In this time also, our fathers visit the cabins of the town to baptize the sick and to instruct the well. As for me, my employment is the study of the language, watching the cabin, helping the Christians and the catechumens to pray to God, and keeping school for the children from noon until 2 o'clock, when the bell rings for examination of conscience. At 4 o'clock in the evening, the savages who are not Christians are sent away, and we quietly say altogether our matins and lauds, at the end of which we hold mutual consultation for 3/4 of an hour about the advancement of and the hindrances to the faith in these countries. Afterwards, we confer together about the language until supper, which is at 6:30. At 8 o'clock, the litanies, examination of conscience, and then we retire to sleep. Father Jean de Brebeuf and his confreres visited the sick each day, comforting them and instructing them in the truths of the Christian faith. As often as possible, they gathered together the children of the village and sat them down in the cabin. Father Brebeuf would put on his surplice and biretta and chant the Our Father, which Father Daniel had translated into Huron rhymes, and the children would chant it after him. Next, he taught them the sign of the cross, the Hail Mary, the Apostles' Creed, and the commandments. Briefly recalling the contents of the previous instruction, he would explain some new point in the faith to the children, then question them upon their understanding of it. Two little French boys who had been brought up to Ianoteria would sum up the lesson and put questions to each other, a performance which filled the Indians with delight. When the session was over, Brebeuf would present to them with a few beads, raisins, or prunes, and dismiss them. Great rivalry in the faith grew up among this small fry of Oronia. The youngsters would gather in groups about the village, vying with one another in making the sign of the cross or in chanting the rhymes they had learned, to the amusement and satisfaction of the priests. On October 20th, Brebeuf set out to visit the Petun, or Tobacco Indians, a distinct nation of the Hurons. He was cheerfully greeted there, and he secured pledges of friendship. While with the Petuns, painstakingly preparing the way for other missionaries who might ultimately found missions among them, he baptized three sick children before they died. He traveled through the January snows to Tiernavskaya, the capital village of the Cord Nation, another branch of the Hurons where the Indians who had escorted him to Huronia the summer before lived. He wished to thank them for this and to enlist the help of one of their number, Louis Amantacha, in planting the seeds of Christianity among his people. Louis was a Christian who had studied with the Recollet fathers in France. He had escaped recently from the Iroquois, and Brebeuf felt that he could be helpful to the missionary effort. The chiefs of the Huron Federation were in Tiernavskaya consulting about peace with the Iroquois Senecas. In council, they invited Brebeuf to accompany their delegation, but he was aware that treachery on one side or the other was possible, and he diplomatically declined, thinking it prudent not to become embroiled in tribal politics. Writing to Lejeune, he said that if he went to the Senecas at all, he would go as an ambassador of Christ only. Brebeuf returned to Ionoteria, where he resumed his patient ministry among the Hurons. Not long after his arrival, a young brave, Oatai, being in poor health, asked for baptism. He had been amply instructed in the Christian faith, and the priest consented. He planned to create a fresh new impression on the minds of the villagers, and to this end he christened Oatai with particularly solemn rites in the chapel, bestowing upon him the name of Joseph. The ceremony made a powerful impact upon the watching throng, and this was strengthened a few days later, April 14th, when Joseph's illness became critical, and Brebeuf administered extreme unction. This was the first time the sacrament had been given in Huronia. Joseph soon died, and Brebeuf conducted the full Catholic ritual when he was buried. In that spring of 1635, a serious drought settled on the Huron country, bringing the customary panic into the hearts of the natives. Years before, at Toanche, the great Huron sorcerer, Teron Hagnon, had failed to bring rain, but the clouds had come and had opened up when Brebeuf and the Indians had honored the crucifix. Now again, in the nearby village of Andiate, Teron Hagnon's incantations availed nothing, and again he asserted that Echan and the other black robes were causing the drought by means of a demon housed in the cross above the mission cabin. The corn would rot, he said, and the people would starve unless the cross was taken down and destroyed. The warning swept the villages, and a swarm of Hurons whirled into Ianoteria and demanded that the cross be taken down or they would burn the house to the ground. Brebeuf faced the mob and asked them to attend a council which would be called by the chiefs of Ionateria. This was done, and he told the uneasy multitude that it is not in the power of a Huron sorcerer or a French black robe to bring rain when it is needed. That cross, he continued, has been there for 10 months. There has been rain and snow all winter. Hence, it cannot be the cause of the drought. Hate sin. Give up your superstitious practices. Love God. Serve him and pray to him with confidence, and he will hear you. He invited them to join in a procession every day for 9 days, and they agreed to do so. That night, the priests agreed that each would offer a novena of masses in honor of St. Joseph. On June 5th, the novena began. The priests offered their masses each day, and each day the missionaries, the 6 Frenchmen, and the Hurons marched in solemn procession through the village, chanting prayers. 8 of the 9 days passed, and no rain had fallen. The 9th day opened clear and bright, and tension mounted. The procession formed and wound through the village streets. Clouds were gathering. Before they could reach the chapel again, the marchers were drenched in a torrent of rain. Brebeuf was no less grateful than the Hurons. These rains, he wrote, stifled the false opinions and notions conceived against God, the cross, and ourselves. The savages declared that in the future they would serve God. They uttered 1,000 abusive words against their sorcerer, Terenhagenon. To God be forever the glory of the whole. He permits the dryness of the soil in order to bedew all hearts with his blessings. Again, in late July, a drought endangered the corn crop, and the Indians appealed to Echon. He and his 2 companions responded with a novena of masses in honor of the founder of the Society of Jesus, Ignatius Loyola, whose feast day was approaching. On the 23rd of the month, which was the 2nd day of the novena, as the priests and the Hurons were marching in procession, chanting prayers, the heavens opened with a heavy downpour of rain, which saved the parched crops of corn. Amidst the distractions and alarms of life among the Indians, Brebeuf and his confreres carefully preserved the full vigor of their interior life. That summer, they made their annual retreat of 8 to 10 days, following the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. For these spiritual exercises, remarked Brebeuf, we have so much more the need, since the sublimity of our labors requires so much the more a union with God, and since we are forced to live in continual turmoil, this makes us frequently realize that those who come here must bring a rich fund of virtue with them, if they wish here to gather the fruits thereof. In addition to the spiritual exercises prescribed by the society, Brebeuf performed many other devotions and penances, and was careful to do so in as great privacy as possible. To the continual sufferings, wrote his spiritual director, which are inseparable from the duties which he had in the missions, on the journeys in whatever place he was, and to those which charity caused him to embrace, often above his strength, although below his courage, he added many voluntary mortifications. And after all these, his heart could not be satiated with sufferings, and he believed that he had never endured aught. On August 13th, Brebeuf welcomed Father François Le Mercier, and 4 days later, Father Pierre Pijard. These 2 Jesuits had come from Quebec to help advance the Huron mission. They handed him a letter from Champlain, in which the governor addressed himself to the Hurons. In it, he repeated what he had told the Hurons who had come to Quebec that summer to trade. Brebeuf read the letter to the assembled Indians, whom Champlain counseled to love the black robes and believe in God, to give no heed to the sorcerers, but to listen to the black robes. "The French will go in goodly numbers to your country," the letter read. "They will marry your daughters when they are baptized Christians. They will teach you to make hatchets and knives." The Hurons, who had just come from Quebec, were amazed to hear Echon read to them the very words they had heard Champlain speak. How, they wondered, could Echon hear with his eyes the words which Champlain had spoken at a place 30 days' journey away? "Next year," the letter went on, "you must bring some of your boys down to Quebec and leave them here for the winter. They will bind the Hurons and the French more closely together. Then, up in your own country, you must hold a great council of all the chiefs of the Wyandots to consult on these matters. You must invite Echon to speak at that council." Surely, thought the Hurons, Echon must be a great sorcerer. During that fall and winter, Brebeuf regularly assembled the older Huron men in his cabin. He explained the existence of God to them and drew many illustrations from the laws of nature. He spoke to them about the Ten Commandments and how they must live if they truly believed in God and wished to enter paradise. The Hurons, Brebeuf reported, acknowledged the commandments to be very just and very reasonable. They thought these were matters of great importance worthy of being discussed at the councils. They admitted the logic of his conclusions about God and his attributes, but alas, "they know the beauty of truth," he commented sadly. "They approve of it, but they do not embrace it. They condemn their wicked customs, but when will they abandon them?" The step from belief to action was a long step, and they hesitated to pass from acknowledgement of God's existence to conformity with his laws. Among the young, progress was more marked. 3 little girls had mastered the catechism so thoroughly and gave such clear evidence of interior piety that Brebeuf and Daniel judged them ready for baptism. Inviting the whole village to attend the ceremony, which took place on the feast of the Immaculate Conception, December the 8th, they performed the ritual with all possible solemnity. The chapel was thronged with Hurons when the 3 girls, beautifully apparelled and ornamented with strings of wampum and porcelain, renounced Satan and all his works and received the waters of regeneration. The Jesuit community that morning dedicated the Huron missionary to the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin. They promised to offer 12 masses in the ensuing year toward accomplishing in Huronia the erection of a permanent church named after the Immaculate Conception. "We believe," wrote Brebeuf, "that the Blessed Virgin has accepted our humble devotions. Before the end of December, we baptized 28. The following year, 1636, was fruitful. Le Borgne, the treacherous chief of the island of the Alamettes, visited Ionateria with new plots and departed unsuccessful, but with thanks to Brebeuf for the priest's diplomatic consent to come to the island later on bearing gifts. The Iroquois were ranging Huronia and making hit-and-run attacks, and Brebeuf prevailed upon the Hurons to do away with their circular fortifications in favor of square palisades with defensive towers at each corner. Amid all his duties, he wrote, at the request of Lejeune, a comprehensive survey of all he had learned about the Hurons, an invaluable document for missionary purposes and to historians for 3 centuries. With it, he enclosed a booklet entitled Directions for Priests of Our Society Who Shall Be Sent to the Hurons, setting out in close detail the requirements of character, deportment, courtesy, and method in laboring with these Indians. Finally, as superior of the Huron mission, he sent his official report to the general of the society in Rome, wherein he reiterated, as in his booklet, the need for gentleness, patience, generosity, and example if one was to make true spiritual progress in Huronia. Brebeuf received a long letter from Lejeune which told the joyous news that 8 ships had arrived with an abundance of supplies, hundreds of colonists, 6 priests and 2 brothers. In partial counterbalance, Lejeune related the sorrowful news of Champlain's death, and Brebeuf could do neither more nor less than concur in Lejeune's tribute to this old friend. Truly, he led a life of great justice, equity, and perfect loyalty to his king and toward the gentlemen of the company. But at his death, he crowned his virtues with sentiments of piety so lofty that he astonished us all. On the evening of August 12th, Brebeuf learned that a black robe had landed at the cove beneath Yonateria. He hurried down and came upon Father Pierre Chastelain, whom Aenon Indians had brought there. The next day, Father Charles Garnier arrived, and joy was unrestrained in Huronia. That summer, Daniel and Davost traveled to Quebec. They took with them 3 Huron boys, whom they planned to train as helpers in evangelizing their people. 12 boys had originally promised to go, but maternal affection proved too strong. But with the 3 who persevered, a start could be made. Vice was still rampant among the Hurons, and the priests were bent on getting at least some of the youths into an environment where they would be protected against daily examples of profligacy. The Ursuline convent had effected such striking results with Indian girls that the missionaries thought to accomplish as much with the boys. On September 2nd, Brebeuf baptized the first Iroquois ever to become a Christian. He was a Seneca chief whom the Hurons had captured and brought to Arantayen, a village about 5 miles from Yonataria. Brebeuf, anxious to save the soul of a man who was destined for burning at the stake, explained the truths of the Christian faith, dwelling especially on the doctrine of offering up sufferings for the atonement of sins and for the happiness of heaven. The captive was amazed that the missionaries would show such concern for his welfare, and he listened attentively. As Brebeuf instructed him, Garnier and Le Mercier prayed for him and vowed to offer up 4 masses in honor of the Blessed Virgin if she should win him to baptism. Finally, he requested to be baptized, and this was done without hesitation, so well disposed had he proved himself. The Huron chief had not decided whether to adopt him or kill him, and the captive was feasted for 2 days. Then it was decreed that he should be tortured and burned. On September 4th, the victim held his farewell feast and, as the host, offered to his captors the food that had been given him. While they gorged themselves, he kept shouting, "My brothers, I am about to die. Amuse yourselves boldly with me. I fear neither your tortures nor death." He sang songs of defiance and danced up and down while the Hurons applauded. 11 fires were kindled that night in the longhouse of the war chief. As soon as the prisoner was led in, braves pounced on him like tigers, tearing at him, beating him, pursuing him with flaming torches as he ran wildly from one end to the other. They would often stop him to break the bones of his hands. Some pierced his ears with sharp sticks and bound his wrists with cords, which they pulled on with all their strength. At one point he fell, and the elders, fearful he might die that night, stopped the tortures, only to resume them when he revived. At intervals they would desist to give him water and corn, and on these occasions Brebeuf was able to come near enough to the captive to console him. The Hurons could not understand his solicitude for the prisoner. "Do you think," one of them asked, "that because of what you say and do now to this Iroquois, the Iroquois will treat you better if sometime they come to ravage our country?" "That is not what concerns me," replied Brebeuf. "All I think of now is to do what I ought. We have come here only to teach you the way to heaven. In regard to ourselves, we leave that entirely to the providence of God." The Iroquois was alive at dawn. They led him outside of the village and tied him to a post on a scaffolding 6 feet high. They seared him with torches and thrust these down his throat and into his fundament. They fastened red-hot hatchets about his shoulders and burned his eyes. They cut off a foot, then a hand, and finally severed the head from the shoulders. The trunk was dismembered and put into kettles, and the Indians ate with relish the flesh of an Iroquois. As the missionaries walked home after the slaughter, the shrieks of the Seneca chief rang in their ears, and the specter of his tormented body stood before their eyes. They offered up their masses on the next morning for the repose of the soul of the first Seneca and the first Iroquois to die as a Christian. There were now enough priests and lay helpers at Ianatiria to extend the missionary enterprise, and with fresh hopes and enthusiasm, the priests formulated their plans to this end. The long-projected crusade to plant the cross in every village was about to get underway. The fathers discussed the aspects of forthcoming ventures one evening, and joined together in prayer that these might be accomplished to the greater glory of God. They lay on their humble cots in a condition of excitement, for the Huron mission was out of its swaddling clothes at last and was about to stride forward. Chapter 8. Events took a sudden and unexpected turn. Three of the newcomers had scarcely got settled when they were attacked by a contagious fever, apparently a virulent form of pneumonia, which turned their mission house into a hospital. Two of the lay helpers were soon prostrated. Medicine was lacking, and the patients grew weaker until they seemed on the point of death. Slowly they recovered, only to be confronted by a new calamity. The pestilence, which for 2 years had visited the Huron settlements from time to time, broke out now with tenfold violence. With it appeared the even more dreaded smallpox. Both maladies raged through the fall, and instead of abating when winter came, reached new fury. Terror amounted to panic and hysteria throughout Huronia. Huddled together in their cabins with no segregation of those stricken, the natives fell easy victims. The missionaries, singly or in pairs, trekked tirelessly through snow and ice from village to village, ministering to the sick, speaking words of comfort, inviting them to say a few simple prayers, and doing all in their power to relieve their suffering. They left a few raisins, a prune, a spoonful of sweetened water with the sufferers. When they were able to make a little broth, they distributed this among the grateful patients. Thousands of Hurons lay writhing in pain. Hundreds were dragged dead from their huts, and not a family escaped. Scarcely a household in Huronia went unvisited by the missionaries. Having done what they could to relieve the Indians' bodily distress, they would tell them briefly of God, of his divine Son who redeemed the world and instituted sacraments to channel his grace to men. They would say a few words about heaven and hell to urge the individual to offer his sufferings to God in atonement for past sins. In many instances, the Indian would remain stolidly silent. Sometimes he would be evasive, intractable, or uninterested in the white man's paradise. "I wish to go where my relatives and ancestors have gone," was a common reply. "Heaven is a good place for Frenchmen," others would say. "But I wish to be among Indians, for the French will give me nothing to eat when I get there." "Which will you choose?" asked the missionary of a dying woman. "Heaven or hell?" "Hell," she replied, "if my children are there." When the priests succeeded in clearing away misconceptions and eliciting faith and contrition, they would pour a little water from a cup or the hollow of the hand as they pronounced the word of baptism. During the epidemic, the missionaries baptized more than 1,200 persons. In one village, where the people were the most perverse, some were anxious to follow Christian instruction, and in the end, about 100 were baptized, including 22 children.
The natives of the village of Wenryo, having tried all the rites and dances prescribed by their medicine men, invited the black robes to a council. "What must we do," asked the chief, "that your God may take pity on us?" "You must believe in him," replied Brebeuf. "Keep his commandments, abjure your faith in dreams, take but one wife and be true to her. Give up your superstitious feasts, renounce your assemblies of debauchery, eat no human flesh, never give feasts to demons, and make a vow that if God will deliver you from this pest, you will build a chapel to offer him thanksgiving and praise." The terms seemed hard to the natives, and they tried to settle by offering only to build the chapel. Father Brebeuf refused to compromise, and the council broke up. The Jesuits, ill-clad and undernourished, with unwearying patience, trudged from village to village to bring physical comfort and spiritual solace to the desolated Indians. "When we see them," writes Francis Parkman, "in the gloomy February of 1637 and the gloomier months that followed, toiling on foot from one infected town to another, wading through the sodden snow under the bare and dripping forests, drenched with incessant rains till they descried at length through the storm the clustered dwellings of some barbarous hamlet, when we see them entering, one after another, these wretched abodes of misery and darkness, and all for one sole end, the baptism of the sick and dying, we may smile at the futility of the object, but we must needs admire the self-sacrificing zeal with which it was pursued." Parkman, with his casual attitude toward baptism, would find eternal folly in the words of Brebeuf so often stated. "I would go to the ends of the earth to bring baptism to a single savage." It was a busy time for the Huron sorcerers. They prescribed one preposterous remedy after another. Arrows were shot at the moon, drums were beaten, they sang and shouted till they were hoarse, and they pursued their weird and obscene dances till they fell frothing, hysterical and exhausted. When all their prescriptions accomplished nothing, the medicine men turned one by one with a malignant vengeance upon the black robes. "They are the cause of the plague," they said. "They seek to destroy the whole Huron nation. Though thousands of our people have died, not a single Frenchman has passed away. Note that nearly all whom the black robes have baptized have perished. Only when they are killed will the spirits end of the plague." The Hurons, having tried all else and failed, considered the new remedy proposed by their sorcerers. The thousand acts of kindness were forgotten. The charges against the missionaries echoed from village to village. The Indians scowled at them wherever they went, and many barred their cabins against them. As the threats became more overt, the fathers wondered when some hot-headed brave would plunge a tomahawk into their skulls. A council was called, and the decision was made. Brebeuf wrote to his superior in Quebec, dating his letter October 28, 1637, from Ossossané, "Where we are perhaps upon the point of shedding our blood in the service of our good master Jesus Christ, I assure you that all our priests await the outcome of this matter with great calmness and serenity of soul. As for myself, I can say to your reverence with all sincerity that I have not yet had the slightest dread of death from such a cause. But we are all grieved over this, that these poor barbarians, through their own malice, are closing the door to the gospel and to the grace. Whatever conclusion they reach, and whatever treatment they accord us, we will try, by the grace of our Lord, to endure it patiently for his service. It is a singular favor that his goodness gives us, to allow us to endure something for the love of him. Now it is that we consider ourselves as belonging truly to this society. May he be forever blessed for having chosen us from among so many others better than we, and destined for this country to aid him in bearing his cross." that afternoon, Brebeuf sent criers through Ossossané to announce that he was holding his farewell feast, which Indian etiquette prescribed should be given by those about to die. Hungry natives crowded into his cabin. When they had all satisfied their voracious appetites, Brebeuf arose to speak. He did not extol his prowess, nor defy their tortures as the Indians did. He spoke to them about God, his love, heaven and hell. They listened silently. The customary grunts of approval were conspicuously lacking. Moodily, they withdrew. The stage was set. But a lull in the general anger came. Sticks and stones were occasionally thrown at the missionaries. Tomahawks were brandished over their heads, but they were not seriously molested. Gradually, they were allowed to enter the cabins and resume their labors of mercy. Threatened sentences of torture and death were not executed. It is probable that the older heads had convinced the angry ones that to carry out the executions would end by arraying against the Hurons another enemy besides the Iroquois, namely the French. These would shift their trading to another Indian nation, and they would also take vengeance on the Hurons. In their present state of weakness, menaced increasingly by Iroquois attacks, the Hurons could not afford to create new and powerful enemies. By the following year, the fears of the natives became almost completely dissipated. Their affection for the priests was restored to such a degree that it was possible now to erect a permanent missionary establishment in the village of Tienestaye, which had been particularly hostile to the missionaries. On June 25th, 1638, Brebeuf and his confreres departed from Ihonatiria, whose population had been drastically reduced by the plague, and moved into their new mission. This they called St. Joseph's II, the first at Ihonatiria having been named after that patron saint of the Huron missions. Father Jérôme Lallemant arrived the next August. He was the younger brother of Charles Lallemant, who had come to Quebec in 1625 with Brebeuf and Massé. Brebeuf was overjoyed to learn that Father Jérôme was to supplant him as superior of the Huron mission, but his feelings were not fully shared by the other missionaries, for they loved and revered Brebeuf and held him to be the outstanding Jesuit missionary in all of New France. They had been daily witnesses to his piety, his austerities, his prayers prolonged far into the night in the blackness of the chapel, his unfailing kindness and selfless zeal. They valued especially his equanimity of temper, so important in a mission where vexations were daily and even hourly visitors. His evenness of temper, wrote his later superior, Father Raguneau, seemed to be the virtue that outweighed all others. Nothing could upset him. During the 12 years I have known him, whether as superior or subject, I never saw him angry or even slightly indignant. Father Jérôme Lallemant had proved himself an able administrator in France. He had read all the relations sent by Lejeune and Brebeuf, and he had learned much about the Huron mission from his brother Charles. His first concern was to erect a large, permanent central residence upon which all other missions in the area could depend. This plan was prompted by the Indian custom of abandoning their villages every 10 or 20 years when the soil became depleted, so forcing the Jesuits to abandon their cabins and churches and build new ones. Moreover, the missionaries required an adequate center where they could recuperate when ill, make spiritual retreats, and give refuge to persecuted Huron Christians. Accordingly, Sainte-Marie was erected with its chapel, guest house, residence, and strong fortifications. From this impregnable center, Father Lallemant sent forth his 13 missionaries throughout all Huronia and to other tribes. In 1640, he commissioned Charles Garnier and Pierre Pijard to preach the gospel to the Pétains, and Brebeuf and Joseph Chaumonot to preach to the Neutrals. The neutrals were a tribe of about 12,000 distributed among 40 villages. They occupied the territory immediately north of Lake Erie and a wing of land extending between that lake and Lake Ontario across the Niagara River and into what is now western New York. Their Indian name was Otiwandaronk. They spoke a language cognate to the Iroquois, and they were called neutrals because they declined to take sides in the war between Iroquois and Hurons. Taller and more shapely than Hurons, they were surpassed by no other Indian tribe in athletic proportions, ferocity, and extravagance of superstition. The Hurons would not torture a woman at the stake, but the neutrals felt no inhibitions in this respect. The neutrals carried to preposterous extremes the Indian notion that madness endows a person with mysterious and superhuman powers. In consequence, their country abounded in pretended maniacs who raved stark naked through the villages, scattering brands from the cabin fires and upsetting everything in their path. Madness was frequently assumed as a pretext for every manner of license, robbery, and murder. When a member of the tribe died, the neutrals would not carry off the corpse immediately, as the Hurons did, but would let it rot in the wigwam until their calloused nostrils could no longer endure the stench. It was to such people that Brebeuf and Chaumonot turned their steps on November 2, 1640. At St. Joseph, they secured a guide, and after 5 days of wilderness travel, they reached the first neutral town. To their intense chagrin, they learned that two Huron emissaries had preceded them, denouncing them as evil sorcerers bent on exterminating the red man. These Hurons had presented the neutrals with a gift of 9 French hatchets on condition that they put the black robes to death. Little wonder that when Brebeuf and Chaumonot appeared, they heard cries of, "Flee! Echon, the demon is coming!" Women and children made off, and the men kept sullenly aloof. The missionaries could only guess the reason for this performance. Possibly the mischievous Hurons thought this was a convenient way of having Brebeuf executed without incurring the enmity of the French. In this manner, the blame would fall upon the neutrals, while the Hurons could present themselves at Quebec the following summer in a condition of apparent innocence and with profuse expressions of sorrow. The neutrals lost little time calling a council to decide the fate of the black robes. The priests, though uninvited, appeared before the council and offered a wampum belt of 2,000 porcelain beads as token of friendship. It was refused on the pretext that the chief was absent. Brebeuf sensed the ominous significance of such a refusal, and with Chaumonot he withdrew. The deliberations lasted till midnight. 3 times the death sentence was passed, but the influence of some of the older chiefs deferred its execution. One of the Indians, who had given shelter for the night to the missionaries, returned to his cabin to tell them what had transpired. He was astonished to find them fast asleep on the floor. They had lived under the threat of death so many times that it had ceased to disquiet them, and a good conscience provided them with defense against nervous anxiety. The Jesuits were safe for the time being, but the neutrals agreed that henceforth none should give them shelter. They tramped from village to village, breasting the heavy snows and forest underbrush, only to find that the inhabitants had been alerted against them, half-starved, half-frozen, endeavoring doggedly to bring to the savages the good tidings of man's redemption. They were driven from every door, struck and spat upon by pretended maniacs. One day, in the forest depths, Brebeuf saw in a vision a great cross. Its stem stood in the heart of the Iroquois country, and its arms overshadowed Huronia. "The cross was large enough," relates Jean, "to bear all the missionaries among the Hurons." In his spiritual notes, Brebeuf relates that when, on the night of February 8th, he was in prayer, striving to conform myself to the divine will and saying, "May thy will be done, O Lord," I heard a voice saying to me, "Take up and read." When the morning came, I took in my hand that small golden book of the Imitation of Christ and happened upon the chapter on the royal way to the Holy Cross. From there followed in my soul a great peace and quiet in the things that chanced to happen. They pushed on till they reached Onchiara, a village near Niagara Falls, and from there they journeyed to another settlement which came near to being their grave. Late at night, trudging through deep snow in a clear cold which was splitting the trees, they spied a miserable cluster of huts. Growing faint with exhaustion and in grave danger of freezing to death, they determined to force their way into a cabin, even at the risk of being tomahawked. They crouched before the door of a cabin and waited for someone to come out. Presently, the deerskin was pushed aside and a brave emerged. They rushed in before he could stop them. The inmates, aghast at their boldness, were infuriated, but once the travelers were inside, the Indian law of hospitality forbade their being harmed. Even so, the young men were restrained only with difficulty from tomahawking them on the spot. "Get out and leave our country," cried an old chief, "or else we will put you into a kettle and make a feast of you." To this a young brave added, "I have had enough of the dark-colored flesh of our enemies. I wish to know the taste of white meat, and I will eat yours." Suddenly, a warrior rushed in like a maniac, drew his bow, and aimed the arrow at Shumano. "I looked at him fixedly," relates the missionary, "and commended myself in full confidence to Saint Michael. Without doubt, this great archangel saved us, for almost immediately the fury of the warrior was appeased, and the rest of our enemies soon began to listen to the explanation we gave them of our visit to their country. In view of the mood that prevailed among the neutrals, Brebeuf and Chaumonneau realized that to continue their present efforts would only incite further bitterness. They decided to return to Sainte-Marie, and they headed off into the wintry forest land. A heavy, swirling blizzard obliged them to seek shelter in the village of Tirton-Dieton, where a kindly squaw took them into her cabin. She befriended them, acted like a mother toward them, and extended every form of hospitality during the 25 days of their enforced stay. This good-hearted squaw helped the missionaries compile the vocabulary of the neutral language, dictating the words slowly and clearly, syllable by syllable. To have accomplished this was a wonder, but added to it was their further achievement of writing a book on the comparative philology of the Huron and neutral dialects, which, according to Father Jérôme Lallemant, was worth spending years of exile to complete. He regarded the delay of the two fathers there as an exceptional providence of God. It is one of the glories of Caesar that he wrote his famous commentaries in the very midst of war's alarms. In every way comparable was the performance of these two ragged, weary, half-frozen men, laboring in a squalid, snow-bound hut amid scuffling children, barking dogs, intrusive and garrulous Indians, the antics of real or pretended maniacs, and a perpetual cloud of acrid smoke that caused their eyes to inflame. While returning to Sainte-Marie with Chaumonneau and four other missionaries who joined them on the way, Brebeuf fell on the ice and broke his collarbone. The pain was intense, and he could not lift his left arm. His companions strapped the arm to his side and suggested that a sled be made to carry him over the trails. Declaring he was still able to use his legs, Brebeuf turned down the proposal, and they continued on. They cleared places in the snow and passed the nights there, while the wind blustered and the cold pierced their marrow. Brebeuf, at one point, confided to Chaumonneau that the pain was severe, but no greater than the agony he had asked from God. "We proceeded joyously and with courage," wrote Chaumonneau, despite the cold, the fatigue, and countless falls on the ice. Their goal was not only to reach Sainte-Marie, but to reach it by March 19th, the feast of St. Joseph, to whom they anxiously wished to offer masses. They fasted from midnight and arose with the dawn. They weathered the sodden snow, the muddy, slushy paths, and the swollen streams. Limp and exhausted, they straggled into Sainte-Marie a few minutes before noon on the 19th. Waving off the customary welcome, they washed, confessed, and hurried to the altars where the missals already were open at the Mass of St. Joseph. This was their first opportunity to receive Holy Communion since November 2nd, 4.5 months before. That evening, the results of Brebeuf and Chaumonot's months of labor and unending disappointments were reviewed. They had not established a mission among the neutrals. They had not won a single convert, but for all that, they had not failed. They had accumulated valuable information concerning the location of the neutral villages and the temper and the manner of the people. They had insinuated into some of the Indians' minds an idea of God, of Christ the Redeemer, and of the afterlife. Two, they had exposed the natives to the Christian character as exemplified in the two missionaries themselves. They had made a beginning, and Lalemant remarked that, "Even if this evangelizing of the Indians is not accomplished until shortly before the end of the world, yet it is always necessary to begin before the ending." Jean de Brebeuf had been in the Indian wilderness for 7 consecutive years, enduring hardship and every opportunity for Christian humility and long-suffering. His powerful constitution had been taxed to the limit. Now he needed medical care, for his fracture was slow to heal and the pain was extreme. On May 20th, he was sent to Quebec to recuperate and to give the superior Father Vimont and Governor Montmagny a comprehensive report on the mission and the state of the Indians. His canoe slid into the little river of Sainte-Marie and breasted its choppy waters. The veteran missionary looked back to the forested headlands above Yonateria and the abandoned village of Toanche, which he had first glimpsed 15 years before. At Quebec, he ministered to the French and the Indians, as well as at the settlement of Sillery, not far distant, and he visited the sick at the Hôtel Dieu, a hospital conducted by the Ursuline nuns. He heard sad news of Huronia, where the roving Iroquois, aroused to furious pitch and equipped with firearms sold them by the Dutch, were taking heavy toll among their age-long enemies. Surely, unless measures were taken to halt for them, they would annihilate the Hurons, who were armed for the most part with tomahawk and bow and arrow. Brebeuf's heart was in Huronia, and recovered, thither he went, setting forth in the first week of August 1644, with 2 young Jesuit priests, Chabanel and Garot. This was his third mission to the Hurons, and his heart bounded with joy. As he stepped into the canoe, he prayed that God would accept his vow of 11 years before, which he had repeated each day since then at the altar, to give his life, if occasion required, for the faith of Christ. He was back at Sainte-Marie on September 7, 1644, and at once he plunged into his missionary labors. He took opportunities also to deepen and intensify his own interior life, and he tells of a vision that came to him on October the 8th. In this, he saw himself and his companions wearing garments stained with blood. Fortified with ever-freshening spiritual strength, single-minded in his fierce dedication to bring Christ to the Indians, he went forth from the central bastion of Sainte-Marie and ministered to the neighboring villages of Huron, Ateron-Cronons, Saint-Louis, Saint-Anne, Saint-Jean, Saint-Denis, Saint-Xavier. Month after month, this strong, gentle, fervent, courteous Jesuit priest trekked increasingly well-worn paths from place to place, instructing, baptizing, consoling. A year went by since he had last embarked at Quebec, and in August 1645 he made his annual retreat. In his spiritual notebook he recorded that every day from now on, at the time of the communion, with the consent of the superior, I will vow that I will do whatever I shall know to be for the greater glory of God and for his greater service. Father Paul Reguneau had come to St. Marie as superior, and of Brebeuf he wrote, "He derived his spirit of confidence in God from prayer, in which he was often much uplifted. At one time I find in his writing that, while he was in prayer, God detached him from all his senses and united him to himself. Again, that he was enraptured in God and fervently embraced him. At other times, he says that his whole heart was transported to God by bursts of love which were ecstatic. But above all, this love was tender with respect to the sacred person of Jesus Christ and of Jesus Christ's suffering." Sainte Marie had an unexpected visitor in September of that year. The Jesuit Father Francis Bressani came, who had been tortured by the Iroquois in April 1644. He had been ransomed by the Dutch and sent by them to France. This summer he had come back to Quebec and rejoined the missions. Brebeuf gazed with reverence at the scars on Bressani's face, neck, and arms, and observed that some of his fingers were missing, while others had been chewed to stubs. A Christian Huron was present, and he remarked, "If there were not a paradise, could there be found men who walk through the fires and the flames of the Iroquois in order to draw us from hell and lead us to heaven?" Reguneau said, expressing the mind of the missionaries, "His mutilated hands have made him a better preacher than we, and have served more than all our tongues to give a better conception than ever of the truths of our faith to our Huron Christians." That November, Brebeuf made a journey into the country of the Nipissings to look after some Christian Hurons who had taken refuge with them through fear of the wide-raging Iroquois. He found, "In the midst of those profound forests and vast solitudes, a whole family of Christians who adored God in those woods, who lived there in innocence, and who received him and his comrade as guests who had been sent from heaven." Chapter 9. In September 1648, Sainte Marie welcomed a Jesuit missionary whose days of service to the Hurons were to be the shortest among all the martyrs of the society. He was to be associated intimately with Jean de Brebeuf, whose service was longest, and the climax of his dedication was to be Brebeuf's climax also. Gabriel Lallemant was the third of that family name to cast his lot with the missions of New France. His uncle Charles had come there with Brebeuf in 1625, and his uncle Jérôme was the first superior of Sainte Marie, which he had founded. Gabriel was physically a weakling beside the burly Brebeuf, but in moral courage he did not compare unfavorably. Gabriel was born in Paris on October 31st, 1610, the youngest of six children. All these but one entered the religious life. Bruno, the eldest, joined the Carthusians. The second son became a distinguished jurist. Two daughters entered the convent of the Assumption in Paris, and the third was a Carmelite. The father died when Gabriel was young, but the mother kept her family intact and saw them to their respective goals. Later, when news of Gabriel's martyrdom reached them, his Carmelite sister knelt down and recited the Magnificat, and his mother consecrated herself as a cloistered nun. At 19,
Gabriel bade his mother farewell and entered the Jesuit novitiate on March 24, 1630. In the midst of her tears at parting, she said, "I give you up, Gabriel, dear as you are to me, that you may devote your life to God as a member of the Society of Jesus. Serve him faithfully all the days of your life, and we shall be united again in heaven." Years later, grateful to his family, most particularly to his mother, for a childhood and youth of rare happiness and love, he wrote in his spiritual diary, "I am indebted to my family, and I must draw upon them the effects of God's mercies. My God, never permit that any of this family for which you have had so much love shall perish in your sight, or be numbered among those who are destined to blaspheme you eternally. Let me be the victim for them." After his 2 years novitiate, Gabriel taught at the Jesuit college at Moulins. 3 years later, he was studying theology at Bourges, and in 1638 he was ordained to a priesthood. The following year, he was appointed to the staff of the College of La Fleche, and in 1641 the society sent him to Moulins to teach philosophy. At this time, there was a tremendous interest in the missions of New France. As the volumes of the Relations were issued annually, they became best sellers. A whole new and exciting world of redskins, forest land, and intrepid missionaries was opening before the eyes of the French. Gabriel, whose own two uncles were there, grew avid for service in the missions, and for this he prayed long and fervently and petitioned his superiors repeatedly. He was always rejected because of his frail constitution and uncertain health. Undismayed, he persevered in his prayers and in his requests, confident that God would grant him this burning wish. Finally, in the spring of 1646, Father Estienne Charlet, the Jesuit superior in France, gave his reluctant consent. "Father Gabriel Lallemant had come last to the war," wrote the battle-scarred missionary Bressani, "and gained the victory among the first. He had asked God for this grace during many years, and having obtained it from him, it could not be denied him by his superiors, although he was of an extremely frail constitution and almost without other strength than what his zeal and fervor supplied him." On September 20th, 1646, Gabriel was welcomed at Quebec by his uncle Jérôme Lallemant. He handed over to Jérôme and the other priests the messages and letters from France with which he had been laden, and he was granted a brief rest from the rigors of the sea voyage. He was assigned to minister to the French colonists in Quebec, Sillery, Beauport, and Three Rivers, and while so occupied, he took every opportunity to study the Indian languages and customs and beliefs of the red men. Gabriel never lost sight of his primary objective, the Huron missions, and after 2 years, he repeated to his uncle the request he had earnestly made upon his arrival at Quebec, that he should be sent west. "It is unfortunate," his uncle replied, "that so brave a spirit is clothed in a body so frail, that a soul so strong is handicapped by a body so weak. But the life among the savages is so primitive as to tax the strength of our strongest missionaries. It would not be prudent to send you to the Hurons, where the physical hardships are so great." "God will give me the strength, Father Superior," replied Gabriel, "and in him I can do all things." Faith moves mountains, and prayer changes the will of men. Father Gabriel had won out again. On July 24, 1648, he departed Quebec for Three Rivers, where he would await the Hurons. There were 4 new missionaries in that party that slipped out from the trading post on August 6th in a flotilla of 60 Huron canoes. There were also 26 French laborers and soldiers, and the veteran Father Bressani was the leader. Over the 1,000 miles of river and woodland portage, the young Gabriel learned at first hand of the tough Indian life,
He ate the watery cornmeal, slept in the open, helped carry the baggage, and to the surprise of the red men, he exulted in these hardships for which he had so yearned. And so, early in September, he was greeted by the fathers at Sainte-Marie. He was delighted to observe the fidelity with which the Jesuit missionaries in this remote wilderness observed the order of their religious exercises. It was almost as though he were stepping into a house of the society in France. During his few days' rest there, Gabriel briefed himself on the work of the mission and his own imminent duties. Sainte-Marie was well-staffed, he learned, but so far and so often had the missionaries to travel that it was rare to find more than two or three priests together there. Sometimes only one priest was present to say Mass for the numerous lay helpers and to assist the visiting Indians in their religious obligations. The missionaries were able to evangelize most profitably during the winter months because the Hurons were in their villages, easily reached, while in the summer they were off tilling the soil or hunting and fishing. The country was dotted with small Indian settlements, and because a missionary frequently had to take charge of as many as 10 or 12 groups of catechumens, he was constantly flitting from place to place. Others were away in more distant parts, among the Petuns, beyond the Blue Hills, among the Algonquins around Lake Nipissing, and they would remain there for months. A few days after his arrival, Gabriel Lallemand was sent to the mission of Ossossané, and there, under the tutelage of Chaumonot, he commenced to make incredible progress in the Huron tongue and revealed a singular aptitude for missionary work. When January 1649 was at hand, he became assistant to Jean de Brébeuf, of whose accomplishments he had heard and read so much. His delight knew no bounds. A few short years ago, he had seemed consigned to making the rounds of the Jesuit college in France. Now he was companion to the giant of the Huron missions. With this personality, he would advance rapidly in the language of the Hurons, and he would master the art of promoting their spiritual advancement. At the side of his tall comrade, he soon was trudging through the snow, taking his turn at pulling the sled, which was laden with their little goods and chattels, through narrow paths covered with snow which, frequently disappearing, left the travelers in doubt and uncertain as to the way they should go. Gabriel confided to Brébeuf that he had sought two favors from God, to be a Jesuit and, if possible, to die for Christ. The first had been granted, and he hoped fervently the second would not be denied him. The aspiration of this youthful missionary touched the veteran priest, who confided in turn that he too had offered himself to God body and soul, and had begged of God the opportunity of shedding his blood to further the spiritual conquest of the Indians. At the outset, the schedule of Brébeuf and Lallemand prescribed that they start off on Monday to make the rounds of their half-dozen villages. They would baptize, hear confessions, say Mass, give instructions, and visit the sick. They were to be back on Saturday to take care of their own villages at Sainte-Marie, and of the Hurons who came there from far and near to assist at Mass. It had long been a profound satisfaction to the missionaries to see, in the words of Father Ragueneau, arriving here from 2, 3, and 4 leagues distance on Saturday evenings, a number of our Christians who camp near our residence in order to celebrate the Sundays with us. Many Algonquins wintered near us this year, and it was a sweet anthem to hear the praises of God sung in 3 or 4 different languages at the same time. This house is a house of peace, so much so that the very Indians who elsewhere are most hostile and most insolent towards us assume a feeling and disposition wholly different when they see us in our own home. During the past year, we counted over 3,000 persons to whom we gave shelter, and sometimes within a fortnight to 600 or 700 Christians, which, as a rule, means 3 meals to each one. This does not include a larger number who came continually to pass a whole day and to whom we also gave charity, so that in a strange country we feed those who themselves should supply us with the necessaries of life. Gabriel Lallemant and his tutor companion, Jean de Brebeuf, made their profitable rounds and through winter storms kept manfully to their timetable of mercy. Monday they set forth. During the week they ministered to the mission villages. On Saturday they were back at Sainte-Marie. Edified by the veteran's zeal, the younger man grew in spiritual stature and advanced in his chosen work. The stringencies of travel and of the rough life among the Hurons did not hinder him or Brebeuf from intensifying that interior perfection of the soul, which is the principal ingredient of active apostleship. The Iroquois were progressively increasing their forays. Toward the end of 1648, a party of 300 Huron men and women, mostly Christians, had encamped in the woods. A large band of Senecas swooped down upon them, massacred most, and carried the rest into captivity. Soon after, the dead were being buried by nearby Hurons, and these were slaughtered by an Iroquois war party that poured out from the forest. The missionaries were profoundly alarmed, for they were not unaware that total disaster might be afoot for the Huron nation. A few weeks later, after this twin disaster, Brebeuf decided, on the light of continuing threats to the Hurons, to change the location of the poorly protected village of Saint Ignace, which was one of the mission settlements visited weekly by Brebeuf and Lallemant. Together they chose an ideal site, which was protected on three sides by a deep ravine and could be strongly defended on the fourth. Under Brebeuf's direction, the Hurons constructed a heavy palisade wall 15 feet high, and they laid in a good supply of bows and arrows and tomahawks. In the second week of March 1649, in a world of soggy snow and sticky mud, the two missionaries visited the new Saint Ignace during their rounds of their missions. They learned that hundreds of braves with their chiefs had fanned out into the forest to sweep it clear of the enemy who were reported on the southern and eastern frontiers. Other braves were absent, trading with other nations. 4,000 or 5,000 Hurons remained, mostly old men, women, children, and the ailing. The two priests, having performed their duties there, walked to the village of Saint-Louis, 3 miles away, where they spent a day or two about their tasks. On Friday of that week, they were back at Sainte-Marie, where they spent Saturday and Sunday. Stephen Anaotaha, a renowned war chief from Saint-Louis, was present and made a general confession. He had a presentiment of danger, he said. Monday morning, March 15th, Brebeuf and Lallemant started out. They spent the day and night at Saint-Louis, and a little after dawn on Tuesday, they said their masses. 3 miles away, Saint Ignace lay in peaceful sleep. The carelessly unbolted gate swung in the breeze, and no sentries patrolled the palisade platforms. A small band of Iroquois threaded their way through the woods, slipping swift and silent from tree to tree, and headed toward the palisade side of Saint Ignace. They paused at the edge of the forest, and they perceived the open gate and the unguarded palisades. This reconnoitering band signaled the main body of 1,000 warriors, mostly Senecas and Mohawks. In waves they swept upon the village, rushed with wild whoops into the cabins, and tomahawked the inhabitants before they could reach for bow and arrow. A few captives were taken. The work was accomplished in a few minutes. 3 Hurons escaped. Half naked, stricken with terror, they fled to Saint-Louis, where Brebeuf and Lallemant were just finishing the prayers after Mass. The priests heard the dreaded cry, "The Iroquois, the Iroquois, they are at your gate." The 700 inhabitants of St. Louis were stricken with fear. Most of them fled in panic. Of the warriors, about 80 remained. Many of the old and sick were perforce left in the lodges. The braves, unaware of the enemy's strength, shouted defiance and, directed by Stephen Anaotaha, manned the palisades. The two priests rose from their prayers and hurried out into the village. Stephen rushed up to them and exclaimed, "My brothers, save yourselves. Go now while there is time." Brebeuf and Lallemant knew they could escape, but they spurned at the thought. "No, Stephen," Brebeuf replied, "I am remaining to minister to my people to the end." Turning to his young companion, he encouraged him to flee. Lallemant begged for permission to stay, and Brebeuf acquiesced. The Iroquois came. With whoops and shrieks, their faces smeared with the blood of their victims at St. Ignace, they threw themselves upon the palisades with the fury of tigers. Yell echoed yell, shot answered shot. The Hurons fought with abandon. Using arrows, stones, and a few guns, they killed 30 Iroquois and wounded many more. Twice they repulsed the attackers, and the Iroquois came back each time with new ferocity. They swarmed about the palisades, chopping at them with their hatchets, until, at several points, they cut through. Wild struggles ensued at these breaches. Brebeuf and Lallemant shouted encouragement to the defenders. Bending over the wounded, they spoke to them, absolving some and baptizing others. They hurried into the cabins, aiding the sick and the women and children. The Iroquois had overwhelmed the defenders at the breaches, and they were streaming through. They killed or captured the remaining Huron braves and swarmed into the cabins. They split the heads of those they found there and seized furs and other possessions. They hurled firebrands into the bark cabins, and what few living persons remained, unable to escape, died screaming in the flames. The attackers fell upon Brebeuf and Lallemant, beat them, bound them fast, and led them with other captives back to St. Ignace. When they reached the clearing before the wreckage of that village, the Iroquois stripped the two priests stark naked, and in turn, with the captured Hurons, made them run the gauntlet of sticks and clubs. Shivering in their nakedness from the raw March wind, the priests were driven with the Hurons into the huge cabin which Brebeuf had designed in the hope that it would one day be a church. Fires were burning about 6 torture posts. Brebeuf and Lallemant managed to speak words of consolation to the huddled Hurons, urging them to offer their sufferings to God. Brebeuf told his companion that if the Iroquois should carry Gabriel to their own country as a prisoner, he should try to escape, as Bressani had done. Each missionary listened to the other in confession and raised his hand in absolution. The Iroquois chose Brebeuf and some Hurons for the first torments. Leaping upon him as he prayed, they broke the bones of his hands, tore out his fingernails, munched on his fingers. When they dragged him to one of the posts, he embraced it and kissed it. Quickly they pulled back his arms and fastened his wrists to the post. They were determined to smash his courage and to make him cry for mercy. Brebeuf was determined to utter no cry, but to pray to God to forgive them. They put burning sticks about his feet, ran flaming torches up, down, and between his legs, around his neck, and under his armpits. Puzzled that he neither cried out nor winced, they held the firebrands closer till the skin frizzled. Then they slashed his flesh with knives. Brebeuf addressed the captive converts in a strong voice. "My sons, my brothers, let us lift up our eyes to heaven in our affliction. Let us remember that God is the witness of our sufferings, that very soon He will be our exceedingly great reward. Let us die in our faith. Let us hope from Him the fulfillment of His promises to us. I have more pity for you than I have for myself. Bear up with courage under the few torments remaining. The sufferings will end with your lives. The grandeur which follows will never have an end. A Euron replied, Echon, our thoughts will be in heaven while our bodies suffer on earth. Pray to God for us, ask him to show us mercy, and we shall invoke him until we die. His tormentors hacked him with hatchets and knives and stabbed him with javelin heads. Jesus, have mercy on us, was the only cry that came from his lips. It was re-echoed by the Christian Hurons. Incensed by his defiance, the Iroquois cut away his lower lip and thrust a red-hot iron down his throat. As the indomitable priest still held his tall form erect and voiced no sound of pain, no plea of mercy, they tried other means. They brought forth young Lalemant that Brebeuf might see them torture him. They had fastened strips of bark smeared with pitch about Gabriel's naked body. When the young priest saw the burnt and bleeding body of his superior, aghast and trembling, he spoke the words of St. Paul. We are made a spectacle to the world, to angels, and to men. Then he threw himself at Brebeuf's feet, whereupon the savages dragged him away, tied him to a stake, and set fire to the bark fastened around him. Around Brebeuf's neck, the Iroquois hung a collar of 6 red-hot hatchets that reached over his shoulders. When he stood erect, the irons burned him equally on front and back. If he leaned forward, the 3 irons burned into his back, and if he leaned back, the 3 irons ate into his stomach. Jesus, have mercy on us, was his only cry. Frantic at being unable to break his courage, they attached resinous bark about his thighs and waist and kindled it until he was a living torch. Among the Iroquois were some renegade Hurons who remembered how Brebeuf had often baptized the sick and dying and consoled them with promises of heavenly reward, and so they hit upon a new torture that was also a mockery. Echon, said their spokesman as he poured a kettle of scalding water slowly over his head. We baptize you that you may be happy in heaven, for nobody can be saved without a good baptism. He did not flinch. They cut strips of flesh from his legs and arms and ate them before his eyes. You told us, said one of the Hurons as he stabbed Brebeuf repeatedly with a knife, that the more one suffers on earth, the happier he is in heaven. We wish to make you happy. We torment you because we love you, and you ought to thank us for it. The priest spoke no word of reproof. He prayed for the forgiveness of his torturers and asked that through his agony, the grace of faith might come to them. Jesus, have mercy, he cried, lifting his eyes to heaven. They cut off his nose, sliced off his upper lip, pulled out his tongue, and hacked a piece off it. They placed firebrands against his bleeding flesh and shoved one of them into his mouth. His tall, erect form sagged to the fires about his feet. He was silent now, but his eyes were open, and the Indians gouged them out with a flaming stick. They dragged Brebeuf from the fire to the torture platform, and there they performed the last rites in honor of Araskoui. They hacked off the charred feet, tore off his scalp, and cut out his heart. This they devoured, and they drank his blood, thinking to imbibe some of his invincible courage. A chief raised his tomahawk over the head of Brebeuf and split the jaw in two. His 4 hours of torture were finished at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Brebeuf's wish had been granted, his vow fulfilled. He had given his life for Christ and sanctified with his blood the soil of North America. Gabriel Lalemant had undergone the preludes of torture. He had been beaten and burned, and had suffered vicariously the hours of his companion's torture. The Iroquois thrust pots of cornmeal mush to him and to the Huron captives, bidding them to eat plenty so that they would be strong for the evening's sport. Gabriel exhorted his fellow captives to hold fast to the faith and to die as courageously as their Achan had died. Toward nightfall, his captors hustled him to a torture post. Like Brebeuf, he fell on his knees and kissed it as if it were the cross of Christ. They beat him with sticks, splintered his hands, and crushed his fingers in their teeth, then bound him loosely to the post. They piled burning sticks at his feet and legs to make him dance, while they sizzled his skin with torches. Again imitating Brebeuf, he uttered the simple cry, "Jesus, have mercy on us." The council had decided that Gabriel was to be preserved as a morning sacrifice to Areskoui, and they moderated their tortures during the night so that he would not die outright. After periods of rest, the Iroquois would fasten red-hot axes in his armpits and place glowing tomahawks against his legs. They held burning sticks against his face and neck and forced them into his mouth. Around his waist, they fastened a belt of bark, set fire to it, and chortled with glee as the flesh burned. The renegade Hurons, as they had done with Brebeuf, poured scalding water upon his head, laughing ecstatically as they assured him they were doing this to make certain he would be happy in the next life. In the still, early hours of morning before dawn, the Iroquois aroused Gabriel from a spell of resting and resumed their torments. They forced fiery faggots into his mouth, sliced off his tongue, gouged out his eyes, and filled the sockets with glowing coals. They chopped off his hands and pressed hot axes to the stumps of his wrists. His mangled body fell, and they let him lie there while they went off to sleep. When dawn broke, they found his heart faintly beating. He would be their principal morning sacrifice to Areskoui, for he had proved as brave and unconquerable as Echon. They marveled that one so small and frail could be so lion-hearted. During all the long torture, he had made no appeal for pity, no cry of revenge, but only and always the simple, "Jesus, have mercy on us." They could not understand. Cutting off slices of his flesh, they ate them and sucked his blood. They ripped off his scalp and dug out his heart before the tomahawk crashed into his skull. His body they threw on the pile of Huron dead. From 6 in the evening, his martyrdom had continued through the ghastly night until 9 o'clock in the morning. After 15 hours of torture, rarely if ever surpassed in the bloody annals of the Iroquois, the soul of Gabriel Lalemant was freed from its charred and mutilated prison and summoned to join his comrade Jean de Brebeuf in the radiant splendor of God. March 17, 1649 was the date. For Brebeuf, it had been the 16th. The embers around Lalemant's stake had scarcely grown cold when 200 Iroquois, flushed with their victories, set out through the forest to destroy the mission center at Sainte-Marie. If this could be wiped out, they knew, the blow to the reeling, off-balanced Hurons would be a deadly one and perhaps final. 500 Hurons, mostly of the Bear clan, were taking up their positions to meet the advancing enemy. Huron scouts came into conflict with the Iroquois, and the skirmish quickly involved the main body of the Hurons. The Iroquois drove them back steadily towards the palisades of Sainte-Marie, and here the defenders, notably the Christians of Ossossané, made a desperate stand. Reinforced by a band of Hurons from the new mission at Sainte-Madeleine, they drove the enemy back in confusion to the still-standing palisades of Saint-Louis. The Iroquois withdrew into the stockade, and after a fierce struggle were driven out. They sent messengers to the main body of Iroquois who were at Saint-Ignace, and the remaining 700 of these were soon hurrying to the attack. One of the wildest battles in Indian history ensued. The Hurons, within the palisades of Saint-Louis, numbered only 150,
Many had been killed or disabled by them. But with such desperate abandon did they fight against an enemy vastly superior in number and armed in large part with guns, that they repulsed them again and again. The Hurons held their own far into the night. The principal chief of the Iroquois was severely wounded, and nearly 100 of his warriors were killed. At last, the overwhelming numbers of the Iroquois prevailed, and when they fought their way into St. Louis, they found but 25 Hurons in condition to do battle. Dead and grievously wounded Hurons lay about the splintered palisades, which they had defended with valor unsurpassed in tribal warfare. Meanwhile, sharp-eyed Huron sentinels at Sainte-Marie had discerned shadowy figures stealing from tree to tree and identified them as Iroquois. This was at sunset on the evening of the 17th, and the Iroquois scouts were reconnoitering before the renewed attack upon Sainte-Marie which impended. The missionaries there kept the lamps burning through the night, and the Huron defenders stayed on the alert. The Jesuit fathers had not been informed of the fate of Brebeuf and Lallemant, and they were deeply anxious for them as well as for the fate of the entire Huron missionary enterprise. They prayed without ceasing, and St. Joseph, their patron saint, was besieged with invocations. "Those of us who were priests," wrote Reguneau, "each made a vow to say a mass in his honor every month for the space of a year, and all the rest bound themselves by vows to divers penances." The little band was determined to die to a man in the defense of Sainte-Marie. Painfully, March 18th dawned, and the daylight hours slowly passed in tense stillness, as if this were the lull after one tempest and before a second. Father Reguneau remarked that it was as if the country were waiting, palsied with fright, some new disaster. The 19th was the feast of St. Joseph, and the tension broke. A group of Hurons arrived at St. Marie with the glad news that a panic had seized the Iroquois camp. Fearful that Hurons were approaching them in great numbers to work vengeance, and in spite of the protests of their chiefs, the entire body of the invaders fled in disorder. An elderly squaw who had escaped from the flames of St. Ignace, and who had observed the Iroquois rushing headlong to the south, staggered breathless and exhausted into the large Huron settlement of Saint-Michel and gave out this news. 700 Huron braves seized their bows and arrows and rushed forth in pursuit. On the trail, they came across the dead bodies of captives tomahawked on the march or tied to trees and burned. The Hurons pressed on for 2 days, and then they committed the fatuous blunder that was to enable the Iroquois virtually to exterminate the Huron nation and the Jesuit missions among them. Instead of pursuing the enemy with full vigor and perhaps inflicting irreparable disaster upon the exhausted and panicky Iroquois, they gave up the pursuit and returned home. It is uncertain whether their decision was prompted by weariness, by inability to catch their quarry, or by wariness of attacking an enemy well armed with muskets. In any case, their move was to prove fatal, for it left intact the Iroquois capacity to demolish the Indian population of Huronia. On the morning of March 20th, the Jesuits at Sainte-Marie received full confirmation of the Iroquois retreat. They had heard, too, of the fate of Brebeuf and Lallemant, and the missionary Father Jacques Bonin was sent with 7 armed Frenchmen to St. Ignace to recover their bodies. The party passed through St. Louis, where the ground was strewn with uncounted dead Hurons and Iroquois. On to St. Ignace they continued, where all was gruesome silence and death. Among the ashes of the burned-out cabins, charred corpses were scattered, and they came upon the blackened, mutilated body of Brebeuf. The mangled remains of Lallemant they found with the tortured Hurons a short distance away. Tenderly, Father Bonin and his companions lifted the 2 bodies on their stretchers of bark and carried them the 6 miles to Sainte-Marie. They were laid side by side on the floor of the living room. Priests, brothers, donnés, and workmen gazed at them with awe and lovingly examined them. Father Bonin knelt for 2 hours by the body of Gabriel, who had been his dearest friend, and kissed the wounds as he would the relics of a saint. They are the relics of the love of God which alone triumphs in the death of martyrs, exclaimed Father Raguneau. The missionaries had learned from a few Hurons who had escaped the Holocaust at Saint-Ignace details of the torture and death of Brebeuf and Lallemant. Confirmation now was before their eyes. The bodies of Brebeuf and Lallemant were cleansed and clothed in priestly vestments and placed in rough-hewn boxes. Through the night, they reposed before the Blessed Sacrament. We buried these precious relics, relates Father Raguneau, on Sunday, March 21st, with so much consolation and such tender feelings of devotion in all who were present at the obsequies, that I know none who did not desire rather than fear a similar death, and who did not regard himself as blessed to live in a place where, perhaps a few days from then, God would accord him the grace of shedding on a similar occasion both his blood and his life. Not one of us could force himself to pray to God for them, as if they had any need for prayer. On the contrary, our spirits were carried up toward heaven, where, we had no doubt, their souls resided. Be this as it may, I pray to God that he fulfill in us his will, even to death, as he has done toward them. Jean de Brebeuf was 56 when he gave his body to the Iroquois and his soul to God. With heavy heart, Father Raguneau wrote to his superior in France, telling the loss of their ablest missionary. When Brebeuf first set foot in Huronia 23 years before, he recalled, there was not a Christian in that extensive territory. Since that day, nearly 7,000 had been baptized, and to Brebeuf, more than any other, that long line of conversions must be credited. Father Jean de Brebeuf, he went on, had been chosen by God to be the first apostle of the Hurons, the first of our society to set foot there. Not having found there a single savage who invoked the name of God, he labored there so successfully for the salvation of those poor barbarians that before his death he had the consolation of seeing the cross of Jesus Christ planted everywhere with glory and adored in a country which from the birth of the world had never been Christian. Among the papers of Gabriel Lallemant, Father Raguneau found written the vow he had taken a few years before in France, by which he offered himself, body and soul, to the Sacred Heart, and begged for the opportunity of shedding his blood for Christ. Father Raguneau saw that Gabriel's death was the fulfillment of his dedication and the answer to his prayer, that in the Iroquois torture chamber he had won the crown of martyrdom. The smallest and most delicate in health among all the Jesuit missionaries, he had in 6 months won, by his iron will and unwavering determination, a martyr's end, in companionship with the spiritual and physical giant of the missions, Jean de Brebeuf.